Arizona Board of Behavioral Health Examiners will now come to order. It is 8 a.m. on Friday, October 14th, 2022. Can we have a roll call, please?
Kimberly Bailey, present.
Robert Charles.
Here.
Mary Coonan.
Here.
Cedric Davis.
Morning.
Patricia Dobratz.
Here.
Megan Kramer.
Here.
Lynette Hennigan.
Here.
Diane Palacios.
Hello.
Polly Knapp.
Here.
Adelaide Zameek.
Here.
Mark Shen.
Here.
Antoine Trotter.
Present.
Thank you. And we're going to hold off on introductions and general announcements just until we have the public flow closer to 9 a.m. But if everybody would please make sure that your phones are turned off. And as a reminder, the meeting is being recorded. The audio from the meeting will be posted to the board's website. So as such, we appreciate everybody speaking clearly and into the microphones. Thank you all for being here an hour early this morning. We're going to first go to agenda item number 3, our review of our September 9th general meeting minutes. My understanding is Mr. Charles, Ms. Knapp, and Mr. Shen will need to abstain. Is there a motion to approve the minutes? Last year's second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. We are now going to go to agenda item number 5, our administrative hearings. And we'll go 5A, Mr. Tupper. And I believe we are.
Good morning, Mom. Can you hear me okay?
Is this Ms. Pelletier?
No, this is a receptionist, Mom.
This is the Board of Behavioral Health Examiners. Is Ms. Pelletier available?
Do you have the first name? Is it Janice?
Yes, correct.
Okay. Is this Toby?
No, this is Patricia Dobratz, the board's chairperson. Toby's a volunteer, though.
Okay, Trisha, is your first name?
Patricia.
Patricia. Okay, all right. Let me put you on the brief hold so I can transfer your call, okay?
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Good morning. This is Tina coming on behalf of Gary Tupper.
This is Patricia Dobratz, the Arizona Board of Behavioral Health Examiners chairperson. And my understanding is your client won't be joining us. Is that correct?
Right. He has a spreadsheet not available.
Okay. So we're first going to do introductions of board members so that you have an idea of the board members that are present. A reminder that this is a public and recorded meeting. And then we'll introduce the parties and we'll move forward with the matter. So I'm going to ask board members, starting with Mr. Charles, to introduce themselves.
Bob Charles, public member.
Holly Knapp, professional member.
Antoine Trotter, public member.
Mark Shen, professional member.
Diane Palacios, professional member.
Mr. Tupper's license. Mr. Tupper requested an administrative hearing, and at that time, the administrative hearing was heard on September 23rd.
We did receive a decision by the administrative law judge that was dated on 10-11. With that decision, there was clarification that was needed. So the state filed a motion for clarification, and the judge has now responded to the clarification that Mr. Tucker has an opportunity to respond to the motion, as well as then the tribunal of the judge would need to respond to it as well. So at this point, the parties are in agreement that we should continue this matter on the status of this case.
Yes, good morning. Mona Baskin, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Arizona in this matter. The state does not oppose a continuance for resolution of the issue that is before the ALJ so that we can get a final decision and recommended decision and order from the Office of Administrative Hearings that can be presented to the board, and then Ms. Pelletier and myself can present our positions on that decision. So I would ask that the matter be continued to the November 4th, 2022 board meeting. Thank you.
Thank you. Is the ALJ aware of the next meeting date? I don't believe that he is, but I do believe based on the timeline of the matter of responses that we will have a response by then.
Okay.
All right. This matter has been ongoing for quite a while. It does appear that continuance is appropriate at this time, but reminding all parties that it will move forward on November 4th then. Is there a motion to continue?
So moved, Megan.
To the November 4th meeting, is there a second?
Bailey, second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. It'll be continued to the 4th. Thank you, Ms. Pelletier, for being available.
Okay. Thank you. You're welcome. Thank you.
This will conclude that matter. We're going to move forward with some of our administrative matters, and we'll start hearing cases closer to our regular meeting time. You want to go to licenses first, Ms. Lowe?
Yes.
All right, so we'll go to agenda item number 9, our applications for licensure. Do you have an update on licenses issued since our last meeting?
Our last meeting, we've issued 209 licenses.
Well done. Let's look at denials, starting with counseling. Mr. Shen, want to remember?
The Counseling Ethics Review Committee has reviewed applications of the following individuals and recommend for denial for licensure: 6 applications based on a failure to pass the required examination, 5 applications based on a failure to take the required examination, and 1 application based on a failure to meet minimum requirements, and 1 application based on a failure to meet minimum requirements and a finding of unprofessional conduct. Total denials is 13.
Is there a second?
Bailey, second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried.
The Marriage and Family Therapy Academic Review Committee has reviewed the applications of the following individuals and recommends their denial for licensure, two applications based on a failure to pass the required exam, and one application based on a failure to take the required exam, for a total of three denials.
Is there a second? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Applications of the following individuals and recommends their denial for licensure. 7, based on failure to pass the required examination. 4, based on failure to take the required examination. 1, based on failure to meet the minimum requirements. And 1, based on a finding of professional conduct for a total of 13 denials.
Is there a second?
Bailey, second.
I'm sorry. Yes. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
The Substance Abuse Academic Review Committee has reviewed the applications of the following individuals and recommends their denial for licensure. 3, based on failure to pass the required examination. 2, based on failure to take the required examination. And 1, based on failure to meet minimum requirements, for a total of 6.
Is there a second?
Yeah, a second.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. We will go to agenda item number 11, a report from Treasurer. My understanding is we don't have a September financial correct today.
That's correct. That will need to be tabled.
We'll table 11C. And Dr. Bailey, do you want to speak to 11A and B?
We just have August then, correct? Okay, so before you have the August financial report, I'll give you a minute to just look through it.
Actually, just to be clear, the July and August are both on this one.
Both included.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. Where does he take that? Sorry.
I reviewed it and we'll move to it. Do we need to take them separate, July and August?
You can take it as one.
As one? All right. So there's a motion to approve A and B. Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Is there a motion to approve the August financial report?
Oh, we just did it together. Sorry, thank you.
No,
they're usually separate, so it's fine. It's.
We'll go to agenda number 12 now. Ms. Zavala?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board. First on the agenda, we kept this portion short just because of the length of the meeting today, but there were a couple of things we thought we'd be able to have time to discuss today. The closing of the second quarterly newsletter for members, you should have gotten the newsletter through your email. For public members, this is something that we do every quarter. Pretty excited about it. We continue to get positive feedback from people just trying to get to understand the board and what we do and what we're all about. So we're really happy about that. We've kind of decided that each quarter we are going to do a board member as well as a staff highlights. I think that's important for people to know who they're talking to. Specifically this month, we did Elma, who's our assistant director, who's been with the board since 2006. And it was neat. I got a lot of emails personally to myself just saying it was neat to hear about her and be able to see her. So if you ever have any ideas or some suggestions of things that you think might want to have included in here, feel free to just email me individually. I know I had spoke with, I believe it was Polly, a few weeks back, and a couple of other members, and had given me some ideas of things we can do after the first of the year, like the board and its, highlights kind of thing. So.
And that gets emailed to all the licensees?
I'm sorry?
It gets emailed to all the licensees?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It gets emailed to all the licensees, and, that's one of the importance that maybe we should consider putting on our next newsletter is keeping your contact information updated to the board. Lots of times people use their email addresses where they work, and then they change jobs. They update the address, but they don't update their email address. When people ask me, I think typically if you're getting information from the board, it probably should go to your personal email, just because that seems a little bit more consistent. And we do get a number of did you keep track by chance of how many we got back that came back to us? Only 10, that's pretty good. Back in the day when we first started collecting emails, we got about 10,000 back. Because so many people, I mean, we didn't communicate. The board couldn't communicate via email, but we can now based on changes to the statutes and so forth. And there's been really, at least from what I've heard out there, I don't know if anybody else has heard that from licensees, a really positive feedback in terms of the newsletter and appreciation for it. So it's received well.
And some feedback about how helpful the board has been.
Thank you, Farm. She gets the credit for that. And then next on our list is an update from Ms. Palacios, Ms. Knapp, and Ms. Meeks. They were able to attend the ASWB board member training that was in Alexandria, Virginia last month. And so I always want to make sure they have an opportunity to talk about what they learned, pros and cons of what maybe our board is doing right or wrong. And so I know I could talk to all three of them after the meeting, and I have to tell you, I was really impressed for whatever it's worth, because after the board member training, they had a lot of questions. And so they came to me and wanted to go through all of those questions. And many of them were ideas that they got at the training on how other states are doing things, or just trying to understand why we do things the way we do. And with that said, we also came back with a couple of ideas that I'm kind of thinking about maybe making some changes moving forward. So,
if I may add something that Ms. Zavala is missing, is that we were just amazed about how wonderful this board is, you know, just by the feedback of the rest of the attendees, some of the attendees, right? So I know she's humble, but, you know, we're really appreciative of the work that everybody does here for the board. So, you know, we just feel so proud there, you know, without saying much, we're just like, yeah. So...
yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. You know, the board in Arizona, with all of you guys and the work you do, really stands out. And as other people were talking about their boards, we did feel really a sense of pride, and also just were able to recognize how much attention to detail is paid here and how hard everyone works so that our board can function as well as it does. That was one of the biggest takeaways from us.
I absolutely echo Polly and Adelisa when just hearing from the other boards and just thinking how Arizona is really, Toby is really, the board runs very smoothly, and just how everything is divided, and the staff does so much work. There's some boards that the board members do everything that the staff does, and so just very grateful for all the work that the staff is doing to help us and support us. And I think it's just it was a really great experience, and to see how much that it feels like we are functioning and smoothly running.
Well, I appreciate that, but, you know, I just always like to make sure that it's imperative to know that my job wouldn't be this easy if it wasn't for our staff and for our board members. You know, I've talked before, when we get new board members, it's kind of hard. I have 12 bosses, and when we all leave and then come back, it can be complicated. But I've been very lucky for some time to have the support of the board members, and it's not always been an easy road. But at the end of the day, it's the board members, it's the committee members, and it's the staff that we wouldn't be able to do without them. So pretty amazing. So
I've got a really good experience.
I'm glad the three of you had that opportunity. Next on the list is a discussion regarding community outreach. This was something that Ms. Knapp had asked to put on the agenda a couple months back. I wasn't exactly sure at the time, being that it was a future agenda item, what all that involved. So what I did do is I had staff upload something off of our PowerPoint from our board staff's accomplishments from last year. And basically it shows the various committees that we're involved in, some that I'm appointed to by the governor, some by senators and the various associations, as well as the
different kinds of presentations and conferences that we do throughout the year at the various universities. Arizona Council for Human Services, we do a quarterly one there. St. Luke's, a lot of the other big agencies. I know, Adelisa, I believe you do the Human Service Council one often.
I need to reconnect with them. Yeah,
I want to bring that back to you to see if that's what you had in mind, if there were other thoughts and ideas, and just kind of, you know, where you wanted to go with that.
Sure, yeah, and I think the kind of purpose of wanting to add it to the agenda was so that we could kind of discuss openly and freely and talk about, like, are there, like, I know I would be willing to contribute and go out and, you know, maybe do something similar to what Adelise is doing, so that we can increase presence in the community. I think we already have a wonderful presence in the community. But I also think the board has really changed in all these positive ways over many years. And to be able, I remember, I think this came up because Toby was talking about being in a conference and everyone coming up and chatting with her and how much those attendees felt it was valuable to just see a face of the board and chat with them and like, whoa, we're real people. Amazing. So just if there are any ideas or suggestions, or is it even being newer to the board, I don't know, is it a possibility for us to, the board members to go out and be it? Conferences, or I don't know, or if that is something that exclusively the board staff would do.
Right. So that's great, and I think it's really important to have this conversation because as a board member, unfortunately, you're a board member, meaning that you have to keep that very separate than you as a licensee. So when I had mentioned, for example, Alisa, she attends the presentations, but not as a board member. I mean, literally, it's been a couple of years now. So there's no reason if there was something out in the public that, you know, I do lots of presentations, and there's no reason if you happen to be at one of those presentations that you could be there, but you'd be acting as a licensee, not so much as a board member. There's nothing wrong with saying that you're on the board, but the reality is if anybody ever were to come to you as a board member, you're going to say, call Toby Zawala, because you can't. If you, there's a rule or a statute that you can point to, you're welcome to do that, but any conversations in regards to it wouldn't be. With that said, you know, when you talk about conferences and stuff, you know, there are opportunities periodically for board members to be invited. It's typically when they invite, like, the three of you, we were able to do that, and that was at no cost to the board. That's always really important as well. So there are opportunities periodically where there's a couple of conferences throughout the year where they do invite a board member. And so we usually will then bring it to the board, and then the board votes. Sometimes only one person wants to come, and sometimes two or three people want to come. So, I don't know if you want to add something to that.
Yeah, I was just going to add, I think, because it's an interesting discussion, because we don't take it off of our resume. We clearly serve on the board, and I think that is something to be proud of and something that we can put out there. But it's a fine line of that disclaimer, too. Like, I have it on every page of my website. Every presentation I do, it's the first slide. It's the first thing I say. Right? It's I'm not representing the board. I may serve on the board, but I don't represent the board. There may be questions that I direct back to board staff because that's appropriate. So I think it's that balance of, yes, we are out there and, you know, we serve on the board, but we can't represent the board outside of
people. And it's interesting, too, because when you say that, I often do the same thing. You know, I'm not the board. I don't get to make those decisions. So there's certain administrative decisions that you enabled me to be able to make, but there's certain decisions that I don't get to make. And so I often am saying, you know, I'm not the board. You know, I will speak, you know, I will give you this information, but it's going to be up to the board members, you know, to make it. So.
Madam President, members of the board, just now, yes, I would concur that this board member serves as a member of the board and the function of the board of regulators, and the primary function is to issue licenses and make disciplinary decisions. So we function at open board meetings so that the public is aware of their decisions and discussions and final options in cases. So that really limits them. That's what we're talking about.
And the other thing I want to add, I had received an email the other day from Adelisa because she had received an email from AASCB, which is a
Association of State Counts and Boards. And she had gotten an email because oftentimes these various associations will get your email and they'll email you things. And so she promptly emailed it to me and said, are we involved in this? And I was happy to reply, not only are we involved in it, but I'm on the committee. Actually, I just got off the committee in June, but I host their monthly hangouts, which you may get invited to. And those types of things, you get to do that. We do need to be cautious because it can never be a quorum. So if there's ever anything that you want to do where you think maybe other members might be there, it's always good to reach out to me to let me know. And then in addition to that, if there's ever opportunities that I think that would be beneficial, as I mentioned in regards to conferences I had mentioned earlier, and I'm going to be sending an email, I just haven't gotten an opportunity, but ASWB's conference is here next month in Scottsdale, and they've invited our members to a reception. Again, I'm going to send it out, but at some point it can't be a quorum that attends, so we'll have to be very cautious on who's able to attend. So I will be in Cabo, so I will not be there. So anyway, so I just had to throw that in there. I would just add, this is for the record, those that may be listening to, I think the greatest community outreach we can do is encourage people to attend meetings.
And I would agree.
Oh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if there's ever an association or something that you think would be beneficial, just send the email. I mean, I may already be involved or we may not. And there may be a reason that we're not. So always open to that. I think that's one of the things that has really made our board who we are today is that community outreach, especially from where we were to where we are now.
So. I just wanted to add to you. I sent a few words of humans in this committee and the telemedicine, telehealth, I forward stuff to you probably, just because for me as a regulator and when they're making these decisions about like telehealth, I'm thinking as a regular, I'm thinking as a provider, like Ash is going to, they didn't think about us when they were providing us or making these laws and decisions. So I don't necessarily say I'm on the board, but I give input as a licensee, and then I recommend that they reach out to the board. And if I get that voice and stuff, which is that they might need to get some input in their space.
It's important because people don't know what they don't know. And right. So if you can bring it to their attention and have a conversation, sometimes laws can be changed or rules can be rewritten based on things they didn't think about because they're not clinicians and they're not part of a board. It's all really important. You want to go to agenda number 13?
Yes.
13, request for renewal modification, 13A. And Ms. Lowe, if you can kind of talk us through this agenda item, and I know there's, you got to update the name or speak to the name.
Correct. So, Madam Chair, members of the board, on the agenda, it says David Smith. It actually should be Gregory Smith. However, I'm comfortable moving forward on this because we do have the correct license number, LMSW 18836. So this is something that I will guarantee that none of you have seen before. But basically what this is that Mr. Smith had requested to go on inactive status in June. And at that time, the board members, it was approved based on the fact that there were some medical conditions. He has now come back and he wants to renew his license a few months later. And because of some medical issues that he has incurred, has had a difficulty completing all the CEU. We do have a rule in our inactive status that when you come off of an inactive status, R46305 says upon a show of good cause, the board shall grant a written request for modification or reduction of the continuing education requirement received from a licensee on inactive status. And I think that you will see by all of the information that Mr. Smith has submitted, there are a number of CEUs that he has taken. There's a number that he's paid for that he's taken, but unfortunately was not able to pass the examination to get the appropriate CEUs for that. In addition to that, we do have a letter from his doctor that he's, in a sense, safe and competent to practice. And in addition to that, I personally reached out to Mr. Smith because I had some concerns based on his medical history and the things that he was reporting that maybe he was not safe and competent to practice. And I wanted to have a conversation with him to understand. And basically, you will see that in here as well. You know, he's been out of work for a long time. He's basically wanting to go and work part-time, I think up to 4 hours a day. And I think it appears that he recognizes his limitations as well as he's under medical care. So it does appear, if the board members were in agreement, that it may need the following for the medical disability in regards to a reduction of the CEUs.
And for board members' information and for the record, Ms. Lala, this would just be to reactivate, but for the next renewal period, you would have to go back to the regular 30 CEs to renew.
That is correct. So what would happen is if the board members agreed today, he would get a letter letting him know that he could renew with the CEs that he has completed. But then 2 years from now, a little bit less than 2 years from now, June of 25, when he submits his renewal, he will have to submit the full 30 hours.
Thank you. Board members have any questions?
I have a question. Is there some issue that the CEUs need to be more accessible for any reason or no?
Can you clarify that question?
Yeah, I don't know why. I didn't see this one. Maybe I didn't.
Well, you may not have seen it because it was uploaded yesterday.
Oh, okay. Do we need to, is the nature of his disability such that we need to, have, I don't know what the disability is or whether we need to talk about it, but, do we need more, closed caption CEUs or anything like that, or is this not...
If I'm understanding that correctly, when the CEUs that are required for this particular individual, it's 30 CEUs for 2 years. There's only three that are, all of them can be done online. They can be done on any mechanism that can be made. And it's three for cultural diversity, three for ethics, and three of our tutorial, and the rest are all basically general counseling. So I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but it's really up to the licensee to determine what he's going to be able to take or not take.
Okay.
And it is really rare. So I don't think it's we're not seeing it often, right, where people are unable to. I have not seen this in 12 years.
Okay, but you don't think he's going to have a problem 2 years from now hitting his numbers?
I think that if that's then he's not going to be able to renew his license. This particular rule is only for somebody that's currently on inactive. And oftentimes people go on inactive for a medical disability, or a family situation. And so when they come back, if they can show to the board, because of all of these reasons, I wasn't able to complete all of my, hours, the board could grant it. But when it comes time for renewal, there is no exception there.
I'm okay with that. I will move that we
approve the modification.
Mm-hmm.
I made that up. So,
make second.
Oh, now that's up.
Okay. Is there a second?
Lots of a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. So do we want to see if there's any future agenda items, or do we want to go to the cases we need to table?
Why don't you go ahead and do the cases we need to table, and then do future agenda items and just do
okay. Let's go to. One second, I'm all out of sorts now. We will go to agenda item number 7C. Kevin Christopher, and we need to table that matter. We'll be tabling that to, I believe, the next meeting. And then 7I, there are three cases for Timothy Kierman. So that's 2022-0145, 2023-0015, 2023-0016, and we will be tabling all three of those matters. Alright. So then going to back to 14 future agenda items. I know Ms. Sabal has been kind of compiling the last couple of months. I know we didn't have time to put everything on there for this month, so I know she's got a running list. But is there anything that we haven't spoke on before that we want to have added to a future agenda item? Okay. All good? All right, then.
So we want to take a break, or are we going to call? All right, we are going to go to agenda item 7F, Carol Farmer. And council is present, Ms. Farmer is present. Hey, if you three would introduce yourselves for the record, please.
Yes, sir. Good morning, Madam Chair, board members, board staff, Andrew Bledington and Flynn Carey on behalf of licensees.
Perfect. And just for the record, Ms. Palacios needs to recuse from this matter. So she's going to step away. Thank you, Ms. Palacios. And let's start with a summary from board staff regarding the status of this matter.
Madam Chair, this matter went before the board in July, and at that time the board members found a number of violations, including 3251-16K, 3232-51-16Y, 3232-51-16P as it related to 1101, 1103, and 1106. Based on those violations and the findings of facts, at that time the board members asked for the voluntary surrender of the licensee's license. After that time, I was in contact with the licensee's attorneys and spoke with them in regards to possibly coming up with an agreement for a consent agreement that would allow her the opportunity to keep her license and but also give her the opportunity to rehabilitate. At that time, I thought it would be appropriate that we add a stayed revocation to that consent agreement, and basically what that means that at any given time she were not to be in compliance with the consent agreement, her license would be revoked. And that was based on the severity of the conduct. She would be on probation for 24 months. During that 24 months, she'd be required to take a three-semester credit graduate level course in ethics, as well as 24 months of clinical supervision. And there would be no possibility for early release. And so it seemed, based on the conduct at that time, it seemed that that would be something that the board members may consider. And so we did make that offer, and Ms. Farmer did sign that consent agreement and is attached number 2 to your information. And that's all I have, unless you have any questions for me.
Thank you, Ms. Lauer. Are there any questions from board members? I don't know who's speaking on behalf of the board. You have up to 5 minutes to address the board now.
Okay, well, I just have a couple of comments, then I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Farmer to make a statement to take questions. At its core, this case presents two issues. Ms. Farmer's decision that it was ethically okay for her to treat her employer, Dr. Lawyer, and her failure to inform her clinical supervisor about that treatment, which was ongoing when Ms. Farmer was placed under clinical supervision a couple of months later. There's been no evidence presented to support any allegations of deliberate accusation of Ms. Farmer. Now, in our negotiations with board staff, Executive Director Zavala raised the concern about Ms. Farmer continuing to practice at her agency. And I told Ms. Zavala that we had discussed that internally. We had already, we had the same concern, basically, after the last time Ms. Farmer came to us and said she felt uncomfortable, she wanted to leave the agency. We gave her the legal advice to not do so at that time, to wait until we had a little bit more clarity today on the licensing issue. If she left that job and went to seek new employment with the complaint hanging over her, she wouldn't be able to discuss the existence of the complaint. She wouldn't be able to explain her licensing status. And she wouldn't be marketable. She wouldn't be able to get another job. So we advised her to wait until we got some clarity today, until we decided how we would move forward. And it would help give the board comfort with this concern. I suggest that we could write that into the consent agreement. We could further modify it to place something in there that as part of the consent agreement, Ms. Farmer will leave her agency, and we could place some notice requirement in there, 60 days or something like that, so she can properly transition. That's all I have. I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Farmer.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak to you again today. Last time I was too emotional to make a formal statement, so that's why I'm attempting to read.
Today I stand before you fully accountable. Looking back, I can't believe I really thought I could ethically treat my medical director and her sons. I didn't fully appreciate the dual relationship and boundary issues. I didn't see how my medical director's role as my employer could have negatively impacted her counseling services. I've been completely humbled by this experience. I should have sought guidance from someone instead of relying on my own incorrect analysis. I should have discussed my medical director's treatment with my clinical supervisor when I was placed under supervision a couple of months later. I'm embarrassed and ashamed that I did not do this. My earlier consent agreement said that my supervision should focus on working with family cases and documentation. I absolutely should have discussed the treatment of my medical director and her sons with my supervisor. I have no excuse other than I did not think about it at the time, and for this, I'm truly sorry. I love being an LPC. I love being able to help and improve people's lives. I've learned so much through this process and in the CEUs I took. I will agree to any additional education, monitoring, or supervision that the board requires to allow me to continue practice. I would be devastated to lose this career that I love. My attorney just told you that I want to leave my agency and find another job. We've been talking about that since the last time I was here. I was advised, as he said, not to make a move until we had some clarity today. I want to let you know that if the board agrees to this consent agreement and I'm allowed to continue practicing, I will give my medical director my letter of resignation first thing Monday, this coming Monday the 17th. I will provide enough notice so I can properly transfer the care of my clients. I want to do whatever I can to make this right. I appreciate the opportunity again, and I'm available to answer questions.
Mr. Perry, anything to add to
the question? Nothing really of substance. I would just note that one of the proposals in the focus and frequency of clinical supervision is how to use a clinical supervisor. I think this is one area where she'll benefit significantly, and I think that we all encounter a lot of these cases where we say if this person had only consulted their clinical supervisor. And so I think this is a way that's really fixed in the agreement that allows her to understand the role of the clinical supervisor, because it's more than just that weekly meeting for making sure you're charting right and dealing with the ethics issues of the day. It's more of a substantive way that she can really know how to engage with mentors. And so that's the only thing I would raise as well, is we've tried to build in, I think, a fail-safe so that she is more effectively using clinical staff and reaching out to people who can be mentors to her.
There were two things that stood out to me going into this, and one was the concern about continuing an ongoing relationship with a former client through your employment. So you spoke to that. The second is, I believe at the end of, when we went into deliberations last time, we were going to craft a pretty strict CA, and then we were presented with the previous violations and CA, and that's when we moved into the requesting for the surrender. And so help us reconcile what's different between a CA, the last one, and this one. Like, what's going to make it stick? Because you had the first opportunity and then this violation occurred. So what's going to be different if we allow you to continue practicing this time?
I think the biggest difference is that the last time I didn't see that I felt like I had done my homework and didn't see a need to bring this case before my supervisor. But I can see today that I feel like I need to bring all cases to my supervisor, no matter what the focus, going forward. And that way I'm making sure that I'm on track no matter what I'm doing. So that would be my proposal, is to, and especially I'll be meeting more frequently, so to bring every case and discuss every case start to finish and not feel like I'm cherry picking the ones that I feel are of substance. All of them are of substance. That would be the way I would use it differently.
Thank you. Do other board members have questions? All right, this will be our time to talk amongst ourselves. We ask that you not interrupt. Again, we don't need to rehash the violations. We're just here in regards to the request to accept the signed modified consent agreement. Dr. Berger, do you want to take it?
So I'll just go on record saying I appreciate this morning's presentation. That's helpful to hear. And I appreciate the question of what's different, because it's not super comforting issuing multiple CAs, especially kind of back to back. So, I mean, I gave that a lot of thought, and I don't think the current consent agreement, though, is strict enough if we are going to consider letting her practice. And so some of the things that I, especially hearing this morning, if we're hearing, which I think is wonderful, that every case needs to be presented as a supervisor, that won't happen with what we currently have. And so I'm in support of the ethics class. I would like to propose that we consider, if we're going to give a consent agreement, that we just make the supervision formal once a week for the whole 2 years. And that way there is more time to discuss cases and models and how to use supervision and what's going on with ourselves as a therapist and documentation and the hours gone. So at least four times a month, you know, a formal individual supervision would at least allow, I think, ample time for what's actually being proposed by the licensee today. I would also feel a little bit more comfortable. I am absolutely in agreement that we need the follow through, that we will not be practicing at this agency. Otherwise, it just doesn't feel like we could move forward. So that feels good. And then the second stipulation is that the licensee cannot go into private practice until she's off the consent agreement, just to make sure that we have a lot of formal oversight and ample access to all records, but because it's under the umbrella of the agency.
And to clarify, she can work for a private practice, but she can't own a private practice.
Okay. She can't open up the PPO. She's an LPC. Okay, right. Yeah. I would also just want to be clear about what the supervisor's report. Does this include? Would we have to indicate that the supervisor would need to report back quarterly to the board?
It's already in here.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So those are things that I would propose that we include if we want to move in that direction.
And I think I would like us to be a little bit more specific about the exit from the current role. I think 60 days is a long time. Perhaps we should give a shorter period to give notice. Like, I don't see why notice can't be given in the next week, for example, and then an exit as soon as is, like, ethically practicable or something like that, because I just feel like we have a continuing relationship.
How many clients are on your caseload currently, Ms. Fuller?
I have 55 current.
55 current clients.
Yeah.
I added that up for you.
And Madam Chair, if I could just also say that I believe that Ms. Farmer is the lead therapist. So I respect that 60 days may be too long, but if she were to give her notice on Monday, I think we all would consider possibly a 30-day notice is usually appropriate in those types of positions.
I was going to say 4 to 6 weeks probably to transition a whole case load.
How does she stop that? She might have to pay their practice and new patients.
Taking on new clients, yeah. Would everybody be comfortable with fully transitioned out within 6 weeks, notice this week, and then within 6 weeks transitioned out?
Yeah.
The discussion is making me think about caseload size.
Right,
so we're having like weekly supervision, you know, for 2 years, no early release and things like that. And should we be thinking about caseload size, or is that not?
I think we have to trust her and the supervisor. I think that's part of the monitoring process. In my opinion, though, I don't know.
We could add that as something we talk about.
Caseload management?
Yeah, I like that.
Just to clarify, so we're proposing weekly supervision for the entire 24 months. I'm fine with it. I just didn't know if there was any interest or recommendation for a supervisor to say after the first 12 months, twice a month. But I could go either way. I'm just thinking weekly is a lot. And considering everything that's happened, I agree with the weekly. Just after 12 months of weekly, could there be a possibility of saying, okay, we can go twice a month? I'm just throwing that out there to the board members to see what you have any thoughts on that.
My concern with that, and I appreciate that, Mark, that you know, how that really works practically. It's just that we're coming off another consent agreement as well, and so it just feels like we need a lot of habit of how to staff and how to work with supervision, and that the importance for whoever the new supervisor is, that this needs to really be changed. And then I think we're setting the licensee up for better success in the future. And I would love that.
And she's independently licensed, and it's been in a leadership role, so if there's any chance that it's going to turn into her supervising at some point, I think it's really necessary to really understand clinical supervision and utilize it.
Do we need to identify if, for some reason, they don't meet a certain week because of some scheduling issue that hour should be made up in that month, so she still get 4 hours a month?
How do we handle that in the current reports?
Typically, I mean, that does happen periodically. Typically, they do make it up on their own, maybe not in that particular month. But if they were to submit a quarterly report where they had to have 12 visits and they only did 10, that next quarter we would add the two onto that. So, and we also are aware on occasions when we tend to get lots of missed ones, we will reach out and make sure. But it's usually for vacation is usually what we see.
Do you want to read back what you've
said? I think it would be beneficial for me to read back kind of from the beginning what that consent agreement would look like. And being that this matter has been remanded to a formal hearing, I think it'd be important to see if the licensee would be willing to sign something like this. Otherwise, the next step would be to remand to a formal hearing. There'll be no more negotiations. So we'd be offering a consent agreement for 24 months. It would be a stayed revocation. She'd be required to take a 3-credit graduate level course in behavioral health ethics. She would be required to get weekly clinical supervision for the full 24 months. The focus would be on how to use a clinical supervisor, the board's rules and statutes, the decision-making process, behavioral health ethics, multiple relationships and dual relationships, in addition to caseload management. She also would be required to move positions from her current agency, and it must be fully transitioned within 6 weeks. In addition to that, we will add a modification on there that she cannot accept any new clients at that current agency for the protection of those clients and the transition, as well as a practice restriction that on the time of the clinical supervision, she would not be able to own her own private practice.
This is maybe me being picky. Can we add the language for the resignation that it's in order to avoid the relationships with former clients? I just think memorializing why we're asking for that, this isn't our normal practice, but there's a reason for this.
And we wanted to give notice next week. I guess
I think that's really difficult to put in a CA. I think if we make it clear it has to be fully transitioned in 6 months, I think that Ms. Farmer, or 6 weeks, sorry. I think Ms. Farmer will share that she would give her notice on Monday. I think we just have to trust that it's been difficult for the board to be able to
do
that. And Ms. Zavala, not to talk out of turn, but if that were proposed, it would be something that Ms. Farmer would sign.
Would sign?
She would.
And just for the record, as part of that motion that I just shared, and if not signed, remand to a formal hearing, recognizing she's willing to sign it.
Is there a motion?
So moved.
Second. Roll call, please.
Kimberly Bailey.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Mary Cunard.
Aye.
Cedric Davis.
Aye.
Patricia Dobratz.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Carly Knapp.
Aye.
Megan Kramer.
Aye.
Adelaide Zanuck.
Aye.
Mark Shen.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
It's a great opportunity, Ms. Farmer. Best of luck to you. Thank you both.
Thank you very much. All right, good morning. Good morning, everybody. We're going to go back on the record. It is 9:02. Good morning to the public that has now joined us. My name is Patricia Dobrev. I am the board's chairperson. Please make sure your phones are turned off or on silent. If you need the restrooms during the course of the meeting, they are out those doors across from the elevators. There's also vending machines out there as well. At this time, I'm going to ask that board members and board staff introduce themselves, starting with Mr. Charles.
Bob Charles, public member.
Holly Knapp, professional member.
Angela Trotter, public member.
Mark Shen, professional member.
Diane Palacios, professional member.
Lynette Hennigan, professional member.
I'm just wondering where to start.
Do you want to have time for your years of experience?
Professional member.
Mary Coonrod, public member.
Megan Kramer, public member.
Arale Sami, professional member.
Aaron Yabu, deputy director.
Jared Carver, investigations manager.
Toby Zavala, executive director.
Lynn Lebaskin, assistant attorney general, representing the board.
All right. Our first matter, now that we are back on the record, we're going to be going to our consent agenda. So that's agenda item number 4. The cases that are listed on the consent agenda do come with a board recommended action. Board members do have all of the materials for those cases. We have reviewed them, and we are ready to vote on those matters as they appear. I'm going to go through some of the cases and ask if there's anybody here who wishes to pull that matter. What I mean by that is if you are here on that matter and you disagree with the way it is on the agenda and you wish to address the board, then you would let us know, and then we would take that matter separately. So we're first going to go to 4A, our cases recommended for dismissal. Is there anybody here who wishes to pull A1 or 2, Julianne Cartwright? Is there anybody here who wishes to pull A3, Caitlin Martino? Is there anybody here who wishes to pull A4, Crystal Southway? All right, is there a motion to dismiss A1 through 4?
Davis moves it.
Palacios second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. 4B, these are cases recommended for dismissal with a letter of concern. Is there anybody who wishes to pull B1, Christy Bierman? B2, Heather Bessa? Is there a motion to dismiss with a letter of concern?
Davis moves it.
Hennigan second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. 4C, are cases recommended for release from consent agreements? Is there a motion to release C1 through 5?
Make second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. 4D, bless you. There are cases recommended for opening a complaint and accepting the proposed signed non-disciplinary consent agreements. Is there a motion for D1 and 2 to open complaints and accept the proposed signed non-disciplinary consent agreements? First, second.
Chen, second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. We're going to go to 4E, which is our cases recommended for opening a complaint and acceptance of proposed signed disciplinary consent agreement. I do need to recuse from E1, Michael Bergstrom, so I'm going to recuse from the entire E matter and turn it over to Dr. Bailey.
Okay. The cases recommended for opening a complaint and acceptance of the proposed signed disciplinary consent agreement. We have 4-1 for Michael Bergstrom and 4-2 Sarah Gibson. Is there a motion to open and accept the proposed signed consent agreements?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
We're going to need a roll call on that.
Kimberly Bailey?
Aye.
Robert Charles?
Aye.
Mary Kuno?
Aye.
Cedric Davis?
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan?
Aye.
Polly Knapp?
Aye.
Megan Kramer?
Aye.
Adelaide Sameek?
Aye.
Diane Palacios?
Aye.
Mark Shen?
Aye.
Antoine Trotter?
Thank you, Dr. Bailey.
Sure. We will go to 4G, which is our case recommended for acceptance of a proposed signed non-disciplinary consent agreement. Is there a motion to approve G1?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. 4G, that will conclude our consent agenda. We're now going to move on to our disciplinary matters. So this is agenda item number 7. This is the time and place scheduled for the board's review of disciplinary matters. They will be heard by the board pursuant to the authority given to us by ALS 323281. Please be aware that we have reviewed all of the materials in the matter, and during the course of the meeting, if it's necessary to refer to clients, including if clients are the complainant, please use initials only. Those licensees and applicants on today's agenda received by mail a board meeting notice, which included a list of potential actions the board can take once we reach our deliberations phase. This list is not exclusive, and the board may consider other options. We will first hear a brief summary of the case from board staff. Once that is done, other interested parties, including the complainant if applicable and the professional, will be given an opportunity to address the board. In order to give everyone the same opportunity to address the board, we're asking those that speak not to repeat information that's in the materials you already received. You and your legal counsel, if applicable, will be given collectively the same amount of time that board staff had to present their case, or 5 minutes, whichever is greater. Please keep in mind the board does have a civility policy, and those violating that, any disorderly conduct, will be asked to leave the meeting room. Once the board concludes our discussions with the parties, that will be our time to deliberate and talk amongst ourselves. You're welcome to listen, but we ask that you not interrupt during that time. So we're first going to go to 7E. Mr. Greaves, is the applicant present? Mr. Carey, you're here to represent the applicant.
I am.
So if you want to introduce yourselves for the record, please.
I'm also Mr. Greaves.
Good morning, Chair Dobatz, members of the board, Flynn Carey, counsel for the applicant.
Thank you. Let's first hear from board staff. Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board. So this matter coming before you today is a little bit different than what you've seen in the past. Mr. Reese was licensed by our board, and at the time that she was licensed by our board, a complaint came before us. That complaint was fully investigated, and based on the results of that investigation, there was a consent agreement offered to her. In the midst of Mr. Reese completing the stipulations of that consent agreement, she allowed her license to lapse, and it's my understanding that that was an accident on her part, that it lapsed, not to necessarily avoid completing the consent agreement. So now at this point, Ms. DeVries has now come back and she wants to reapply for her license. Typically in these types of situations, board staff will look at what they've completed and give them credit for what they've completed, and will offer them another consent agreement, and oftentimes it'll end up on the consent agenda because there's been no changes to it. In this particular matter, after review of the information, Ms. DeVries continued to complete some of the stipulations even after her license had expired, such as attending therapy. So what we've done today is put together a consent agreement that Mr. Rice has signed that basically allows her to use any hours that she's completed in that consent agreement. The only change that was made to the consent agreement that the members had previously offered was we did update one of the findings of facts in regards to a DUI. In addition to that, we removed the stipulation for a state suspension. There was a time that I believe that the reason that the members put the state suspension on is because board staff had had a difficulty time regulating Mr. Reeves. And at this time, with the appearance of Mr. Carey being present, he has agreed to stay on as her attorney, and Mr. Reeves has agreed to keep him on during this compliance period. With that said, I want to be very clear that that's not enforceable. That was a verbal agreement, and based on that verbal agreement, we've offered a consent agreement, again, that looks the same, gives her the ability to take credit for anything that she completed already, and the only thing that was removed from the board's original motion was that state suspension. And that's all I have, unless you have any questions for me. Are there any questions from board members for Ms. Lala? Mr. Carey, you and your client have up to 5 minutes.
Thank you, Chair Dobrev, members of the board. I want to put a few finer points on some of Ms. Zavala's comments. Regarding the DUI, her DUI charges were dismissed, so she has not been convicted of any criminal offense. Regarding the consent agreement, a state suspension is often a tool that's used when you don't want to have additional process because someone is acting in a non-compliant way.
I think what's compelling about this case is she expired in December of 19. She continued essentially following the consent agreement into 2021. So she has essentially just continued to go to the therapy. She's done has a very clean bill of health from her provider. Prior to signing or even having this offered, she signed up for staying out of trouble. She completed one of the requirements, which was the burnout, compassion fatigue course. So I think the concern that the stay was used for, which was perceived noncompliance, has been cured. I think she's in substantial compliance with this agreement at this point. I generally do withdraw at the end of my representation. I'm happy to stay on this one, especially because in my experience with Ms. DeVries, and then also in how she has, I think, matured through the expiration process and in coming back into the fold, I think she's demonstrated a real understanding of how the board regulates, how to be regulatable. And so I think this is a nice balance because it still has the teeth of an agreement. You still have the non-compliance section that you can use if she failed to comply and make another finding if you needed to. But she is essentially in compliance at this point, and I think she has definitely the ability to be successful. In fact, by the 28th of October, after she has completed staying out of trouble, she is fully in compliance with all the requirements, save for clinical supervision, which she'll be doing as part of the remainder of this agreement. So I think this is a nice way to sort of transition her back in. And also, obviously, the stay is somewhat difficult at times to be marketable. And this is also with an eye towards being able to get her back into the ability to practice, essentially. And she's certainly available for questions as well.
Questions from board members? This will be our time to talk amongst ourselves. We ask that you not interrupt. I believe there was a lead assigned to this matter. My biggest concern with the removal of the state is that it's a second consent agreement. It's not her first. But there's also been a lot of information presented in terms of becoming more compliant and the willingness to proceed accordingly. But that would just be what I would put out there for conversation is if anybody else has any concerns or...
I think it's a concern as well, but I am willing to move forward and move with it.
Okay, is there a motion to open a complaint and accept the proposed signed consent agreement?
Bailey, second.
Roll call, please.
Kimberly Bailey.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Mary Coonan.
Aye.
Cedric Davis.
Aye.
Patricia Dobutz.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Colin Knapp.
Aye.
Megan Kramer.
Aye.
Adelaide Sanuk.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Mark Shin.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
Motion carries. Thank you both for being here. Best of luck to you. That will bring us to 7J. Ms. Kitzmeyer is the complainant for this matter. Sean O'Keefe present. And is attorney for... And do we still want to get her on the phone, Ms. Law?
I think that's up to Mr. Turk, but my recommendation to the board is this generally would have gone on the consent agenda, but prior to going on the consent agenda, it was made very clear by the complainant that they wanted it to be heard, but that usually means that they're going to be in attendance. I know we've heard from the complainant as well as family members they were going to be here today, so the fact that they're not here, I'd recommend to the members that they consider the dismissal.
And again, complainant for this matter is not present. It is 9:16. Councilman, you introduce yourself for the record. I apologize.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Director. I'm Andrew Turk. I'm here on behalf of Ms. Kiffmeyer. I'm certainly capable of letting her know if there's a dismissal. If I could just make one real short statement on the record, I would appreciate that opportunity.
Okay, but you don't want us to get her on the phone.
I think... If the complainant were here, I think she would definitely want to be on the phone, but I can just give her a call and tell her what happened.
Ms. Kramer, did you have something before we move forward?
I just wanted to say, we read these sometimes, we don't have jurisdiction, and we say you can go back to the court and ask the judge for relief. This case, we had enough. I just wanted to make a record. There's enough there
that's happened, and the judge is not interested in entertaining relief in this case, and this isn't the appropriate jurisdiction, but it seems obvious to me that the licensee didn't do anything wrong, and so I hope this is the last we or anyone hears of this. I just want to say that on the record, but aside from that, I would vote to dismiss.
I think Mr. Turk, do you still want to address the board first?
Just briefly.
Okay.
I promise I'll be brief. And Ms. Kramer, I sincerely appreciate that. And the reason I'm going to go on the record is because Ms. Kiffmeyer has this unique position where she works with the courts, and the court is really her client, and so she frequently ends up with one party or the other being unhappy. And despite the nature of the order that's entered, she is subject to these complaints, and both she and I fully understand the role that the board plays and why the board handles the cases the way they do. And I think this is my 10th or 11th time being in front of you for her, and we appreciate what you do. And the reason I wanted to go on the record is because as much as we appreciate the way that the board handles these things, this is really a case where the complainant is abusing the process in an attempt to intimidate the licensee, and this is a situation where the licensee had moved to dismiss her before she ever contacted him, and she's been whipsawed regularly between complaints that he doesn't want to pay her and doesn't want to participate in the process, and then complaints that she hasn't allowed him to participate in the process. This is just an attempt at bullying. I'm very heartened by the committee members' statements. I do believe it's appropriate for dismissal, but under the circumstances, I just wanted to make a record because I am not at all sure that this is the last time we will hear from Mr. Oakleaf or his mother. And I appreciate the opportunity to address the committee. I mean, the board.
Thank you very much. Board members, have any questions? Kim, do you want to renew your motion?
Yes, I move that we dismiss the matter.
There a second?
Kumarab, second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you for being here, Mr.
Thank you very much for letting me address the board.
Absolutely. Thank you. All right, I believe that will bring us to 7G, Ms. Gomez. Is the complainant for this matter here, Caitlin Skeens? Do you wish to address the board? Okay, if you would come forward. And then is the professional and attorney McClellan present? Okay. And for the record, Ms. Palacios needs to recuse from this matter, so she is stepping away.
I have my husband here.
Yep, he can sit next to you, sure. If you would introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Caitlin Skeens.
Right, and we're going to first hear from board staff, and then we will come to you, and then we'll go to the professional.
Madam Chair, members of the board, so this particular case is a little bit interesting, and I really kind of want to give you a little bit of an overview of how the board proceeds in these types of matters. Many years ago, our board created a policy that we would not open up complaints in regards to the completion of documentation of clinical supervisors in regards to clinical supervisees. With that said, any time we get a complaint like this, we do thoroughly investigate it to make sure that there's no fraudulent behavior or there's unethical behavior. And if board staff feels that there is, we absolutely do open these matters in review. And in this particular matter, based on the allegation, it appeared that there may be something possibly fraudulent going on. With that said, after a full investigation, board staff offered a non-disciplinary consent agreement, and a non-disciplinary consent agreement would be for her to be required to complete 6 clock hours of staying out of trouble. Specifically, the findings of facts are in regards to the 6 clinical supervision session notes that appear to have an altered date after licensee's signature. And I say that because there were a number of other sessions that were done that will not be allowed for independent level license based on the failure of the supervisor to complete them. With that said, as I mentioned earlier, that's not something that the board engages in. Our concern was the appearance of altercation of the dates. When looking at those dates, it doesn't appear that we have clear and convincing evidence
That those six were altered fraudulently, and instead the representation was it was an error, and they made the change. But unfortunately, as a clinical supervisor or anybody for that matter, you shouldn't change dates. There should be a way where you X them out, you initial them, and put the new date or something, which was not done. So based on that, we offered an NDCA that was signed, and that staying out of trouble or equivalent should help the licensee understand the what would be more appropriate in the future. And that's all I have, unless you have any questions for me.
Do board members have any questions for Ms. Lella? Ms. Keynes, you have up to 5 minutes to address the board.
The decision to file this complaint was weighted heavily and a decision not made lightly. Ultimately, I came to realize it was the only choice I had. After attempting to come to her directly, I was unable to reach a solution with Ms. Gomez about over a year of my work having been for nothing. I lost so much through this. I lost 49 hours of direct supervision that I paid Ms. Gomez for. I lost 8 hours of observation for which she received compensation. I lost 388 client contact hours I worked hard for. In all, Ms. Gomez was paid over $46,000 for supervision, office rent, and supplies during my time at her agency. Less than a third of the work that I did actually counted towards my licensure. After all this loss, she was asked how she could make up for her mistake, a question to which she responded she didn't know, and nothing was done. There was no attempt to rectify the situation on her part, and she was unable to provide me with her own documentation to support the work I did, after which I interpreted her actions and behaviors as suggestive of asking me to submit facts that I and she both knew to be false, and my hours were not in compliance. I'm not the only LAC this happened to. As a new clinician, I needed a mentor, a teacher, and sound guidance. I didn't know all that I didn't know. I asked Ms. Gomez to guide me in the process of documenting supervision many times. While I take responsibility for being unaware of the rule requiring contemporaneous documentation in the early months of being a new LAC, I asked to be taught. I felt led to lies and deceit when she asked me to submit my application without the log she knew to be non-compliant. I felt unsupported and criticized by her when I requested 12 weeks of maternity leave. I felt that I only possessed monetary value to her when I was told to work with clients whom I felt ill-equipped and uneducated in supporting. I felt discarded by her when she knowingly exposed myself during pregnancy and colleagues to toxic black mold in our working space. I felt betrayed by false claims she made about me in a civil suit I eventually had to file when she made absurd claims that I harassed her. Ms. Gomez and her attorney made slanderous and disrespectful claims about me in their many motions claiming she had no legal or ethical responsibility for what happened to me. They threatened to countersue me, stating I should be financially responsible for her legal fees. This has been going on for nearly a year. I have lost sleep, been preoccupied with anxiety, distress, and sadness. I have compromised hundreds of hours of time with my family as I've had to verse myself in state law surrounding civil litigations in an effort to be compensated for what it has cost me to repeat the hours I lost. My hope is that this doesn't happen to another licensee and that supervisors take their role more seriously. Thank you.
Are there any questions from board members for the complainant?
Good morning. What were your thoughts about just kind of reading the rules? You know, when we are going for our licensure, you know, we want to make sure we have all of our, you know, boxes checked, ducks in a row, you know, ask a lot of questions. What were your thoughts about not reading all of the rules about what you needed and then what you needed of a supervisor and supervision and the actual supervision?
What were my thoughts on
that?
I guess I would answer that question differently depending on what point in time, because in my early months as an LAC, I had missed that. And when I became aware of it, I did everything within my power to try to rectify the situation, correct my procedures and everything. So just depending on the time.
Okay.
Differently.
So not necessarily a lot of awareness at the beginning. Like, I want to know what I need to do to maintain my associate level license and work toward licensure.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Okay, I'm going to ask you to take a seat so the professional can come forward. Thank you. Thank you to the board. I'm Anne McClellan. I'm the attorney for Lisa Gomez, who's sitting next to me. You have up to 5 minutes to address the board as well. Thank you. First, we understand that Ms. Gaines is upset. We understand, that she has strong feelings towards her work experience with Ms. Gomez. What I'd like the board to understand is there was a mention in a prior case about there are other avenues for recourse, including a civil lawsuit. Ms. Gaines filed a civil lawsuit, and that civil lawsuit has been resolved through a settlement agreement because she claims certain damages related to her supervision hours and damages and economic loss. And the sole issue before the board right now is really the dates on those six of over 50 supervision notes. And I hope that as you reviewed the file, you saw that Ms. Gomez was very remorseful for those mistakes. She acknowledged that although the statutes applied to both her and Ms. Gaines equally, and that there is a burden on the supervisee who's trying to prove that they should obtain licensure to also know the rules, she takes responsibility that she also should have had better knowledge of that. And she's been very remorseful that that was a mistake when she was filing those forms after filling them out. She thought she had written one date down, and she knows in the future that is not how you change the dates. And we hope you also recognize all of the steps she's taken to make sure that never happens to supervise you again. She's implemented an electronic supervision note system so that when she puts her signature on it, it auto-populates the date, so there will be no need for her to go back and look at dates differently. In this particular case, unfortunately, for a lot of these notes that weren't signed within the 10 business day time period, it's because Ms. Gaines didn't submit them within that time period. She would sort of do a large grouping of notes at one time, and there would be no way for Ms. Gomez to then sign them. To make sure that doesn't happen, what Ms. Gomez does is she prepares a note on her own. She does it with the electronic system, and then she sends it to the supervisor who knows, because she's trained all of her supervisees, so you've got to sign this in the 10 business day period, and then you need to return to me your fully signed copy. In addition to that, she's already signed up for the Staying Out of Trouble course. She's taken a supervision CEU, supervisor's CEU, so that she's fully up to date. And as Ms. Zavala indicated, there's no evidence here of intentional fraud. These allegations that Ms. Gaines is bringing up about the civil lawsuit, I am Ms. Gomez's attorney. There were no threats to sue her for a countersuit. That's just by law. There's a claim in there for attorney's fees when there's a breach of contract claim. There was no false information provided. We just followed the legal system and reached a settlement agreement. And so what we're asking is you accept a non-disciplinary consent agreement in this case. You have a supervisor who we submitted letters from several of her supervisees who say she's a fantastic supervisor and she worked with those supervisees to correct this issue once she became aware that she had dropped the ball in the timing of the signature of the notes. We hope you take that into serious consideration that those supervisees I've worked under her for many years had nothing but fantastic things to say about the substance of her supervision. So we ask that you accept the non-disciplinary consent agreement that she signed. Thank you. Do board members have any questions for the licensee?
I have a couple of questions, Ms. Gomez. Your continuing education course, was that in person, online? Can you just give me some?
It's an online course. It's a 30-hour course to be a towards national certified supervisor. So I thought I would do the national one so I can just make sure I know as much as possible.
Okay. And I guess my biggest question is in looking back on how the notes were written and whatnot, did you also notice a lot of deficiency in the note taking itself?
Maybe when she wrote the note or when I wrote the note?
Well, just the note itself. I looked through all the notes, and the contents of the notes are poor.
Okay.
I don't necessarily know if audited, they would substantiate that supervision happens. And I'm just curious if you have rectified that piece, because that's a significant piece I'm looking at.
Honestly, no, I hadn't realized that they needed to be more detailed. So since I'm the one who does the notes now, I can make sure that they're extremely detailed.
And it's in the rules that we do the note as a supervisor. Are you aware of that?
no, I wasn't. I thought it just had to be done. I didn't know it was specifically I had to do it.
Okay. So that's our responsibility, that we note what happens in the supervision and then review with our supervisee that they're in agreement, and then that would warrant then signatures that we're both in agreement.
Okay, because yeah, that's how I definitely do it now.
Okay. Thank you.
I have a question. How many people are you supervising right now?
Currently, I have 3. And I just want to note there's a lot of benefits to national certification, but just like with licensure, there's a lot of nuances with Arizona, so I would not rely on the national training to address the nuances here in Arizona. Yeah, I know. I just now did the 3-hour tutorial on supervision, too. Any other questions from board members? This will be our time to talk amongst ourselves. We ask that you not interrupt. Dr. Bailey?
For us is, even though I asked the question about the content of the notes and whatnot, I hope that was more for, making sure that if an audit was in place, that a licensee and a supervisor would be well protected. So but I know that's not necessarily before us, and I would recommend that we accept the non-disciplinary consent agreement for the education piece.
Go ahead, Doc. I just wanted to note for the record that this doesn't undermine the schemes, the impact on the schemes as the supervisee. These ones are difficult for me, I will be honest, because I think the supervisor-supervisee relationship is the most important professional relationship an associate will ever have. And a lot of it is contractual versus regulatory, which means the board doesn't necessarily, as Ms. Lala said, able to open a lot of these, but I can't stress enough that we owe it to our supervisees to know what we're doing, and our supervisees owe it to themselves to be well informed as well. So, just for the record.
You spoke my words.
Oh.
It's extremely frustrating to see the situation in 24 where the supervisor is not doing what the supervisor is supposed to do. I mean, to have the non-disciplinary consent of it's a frustration for me because the supervisee has really taken the hit.
So if there's nothing else, there's a motion to take up the non-disciplinary consent agreement. Is there a second?
Shin, second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion carries. Thank you both for being here. Best of luck to you. Thank you, Ms. Keynes, for being here. Best of luck to you as well. And Ms. Palacios is rejoining us, and we are going to go to agenda item 7L and M for the licensee, Jade Shelton. We're going to hear these matters together, but let me first ask the complainant for the first matter, Ms. Meyer. Is she present? Do you wish to address the board? Okay, so if you're looking forward, and then is the complainant for the second matter, Ms. Coopin, present? Okay, so you'll come forward, Ms. Meyer, and then we'll hear from board staff, then we'll hear from you, and then can come forward. Is your client present, Ms. Stark?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. All right, we're first going to hear from board staff.
Members of the board, as Chairperson DeBratz mentioned, these are 2 separate complaints on the licensee. However, since the allegations seem to be similar, it made sense to board staff to investigate them together. Following a review of the investigative record, there does not appear to be clear and convincing evidence to support Complainant 1 or Complainant 2's allegations. However, following a review of the investigative record, there does appear to be clear and convincing evidence to support ARS 32-3251-16-II violating any federal or state law, rule, or regulation applicable to the practice of behavioral health as it relates to R46210, R46211, and ARS 12-22-97.
This recommendation is based on the following. Since 11 of 19, licensee has been licensed as a LASAC. With the issuance of licensee's LASAC license, she received a letter from the board staff notifying her that at an associate level, she must practice under direct supervision. The noted statute outlines that a licensed associate substance abuse counselor shall not engage in independent practice of behavior health, but shall practice only under direct supervision. Licensee acknowledged owning and operating a private practice from approximately 4/21 to 8/21. During this time, licensee treated approximately 4 clients with a total of approximately 11 client sessions. It does not appear that licensee had been approved for or even applied for supervised private practice in order to commence her private practice. Licensee represented the following in her investigative interview. Licensee was talking to another therapist and communicated to her the associate licensees can open up a private practice as long as they are supervised. Licensee told clinical supervisor she wanted to start a private practice and asked if she would supervise licensee. Licensee provided individual therapy services to individuals with a primary diagnosis of substance abuse. Licensee did not know she was not able to operate her own private practice. Licensee's private practice is not currently active. It is highly concerning that despite being notified of the practice restrictions in place as an associate-level licensee, licensee did not review the board's rules and statutes or do further research before opening a private practice. Additionally, when board staff subpoenaed licensee's private practice clinical records, she failed to supply records. Licensee represented she kept clinical records through best notes, but has since canceled her subscription. In order to respond to the subpoena, she reached out to best notes to obtain the copies of the client records. However, she was informed that Best Notes deletes the records of inactive subscribers after 90 days. Although Best Notes was supposed to send licensee a copy of her clinical records, they failed to send them. Licensee failed to keep a copy of the records herself and rather relied on an electronic health system to maintain copies without verifying the retention policy. A further concern, licensee represented the following regarding her client's termination of services. Licensee's clients terminated services with her and they just disappeared. Licensee tried to reach out to them, but it's hard to reach people when they get back into active addiction. Licensee did not provide the clients with referrals because she could not get in contact with them, but she could have done that with one of the clients that no longer wanted therapy. Although licensee had email access to her clients, she did not provide referrals or notification or termination of services to them. Although licensee represents she made attempts to reach out to clients who stopped reaching out for services, it does not appear she provided them with referrals or notification of termination of services. And that's all I have for you. In addition to this information, I do want the board members to possibly consider in your deliberation in opening a complaint on the clinical supervisor that allowed somebody at the associate level to go into private practice. And that's all I have, unless you have any questions for me. Do board members have any questions for Ms. Zavala? All right, Ms. Meyer, as the complainant in the first matter, so 2022-0031, you have up to 5 minutes to address the board now.
So at the time I wrote this complaint, I was the clinical director of Virtue Recovery. Ms. Shelton had been an employee as a LASAC for just a few months. I want to say this was over a year ago, so I think it was June that she started. Throughout her time, she was doing subpar clinical work. As you can see by the numerous emails I sent, I addressed this issue with her numerous times without any improvement. So there was that issue. She became very upset with me, alleged that I was a hostile supervisor, et cetera. But if you look at the documentation, I tried to be as absolutely nice as possible. Nearing the end of her employment, which was just a couple of months later, she was bad-mouthing me, she was bad-mouthing the agency to our clients, and our clients were telling us. So she then put in her resignation. At that point, I spoke with our executive director and our HR individual, and we decided that it was best, because of the negativity that was being brought into the organization, to terminate immediately, which we then did. I would have left it go at that. I've been doing this for many, many years, and I have never once written a board complaint, ever. But after I got three complaints from staff about a former client continuing to have contact with her because, according to him, she gave him his phone number. The final incident that happened was one of our young BHT staff, he wanted her phone number, and she wouldn't give it to him. And he became very angry and aggressive towards her. So this put a lot of people in a bad situation. It was at that point that I spoke again to our executive director and our HR person, and we felt like we had no choice but to report it to the board. So I did not do this lightly, but it was concerning to us.
Are there questions from board members? I would ask you to take your seat, please. Ms. Stark, you and your client can come forward. And if you would introduce yourselves for the record, and then you have up to 5 minutes to address the board.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the board. I'm Sarah Stark, and I'm counsel for Joe Chill. We would ask that the board dismiss the complaints related to the alleged lack of clinical competency, lack of professional integrity, defamation, and racial discrimination, and concur with board staff's conclusion that these allegations are not supported by clear and convincing evidence in this case. However, Ms. Shelton does take full responsibility for the mistakes she made in connection with her private practice. Although she did obtain a supervisor and only operated the practice for a short time, through the board's process, Ms. Shelton has recognized the mistakes she made at the time that she did operate the practice. Obviously, at the time she opened the practice, she was not aware of the many nuances required of supervised private practice and mistakenly believed that she was only required to obtain a supervisor in order to see the clients in private practice. She has since reviewed the rules and learned that, among other things, she was required to register and receive prior approval from the board before even beginning the practice at all. She also acknowledges that she should have been more cognizant of the policies and procedures of the EHR service she used. She recognizes that she should have utilized better policies in her private practice related to client termination, notification, and referrals when clients were no longer responding to her. I do want to emphasize that the practice operated for only a few short months. It's been over a year. It obviously is not operating any longer. Ms. Shelton has learned a lot from this experience, and I think she has a few comments to make, so I'll turn it over to her to briefly address you guys as well. Thank you.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak. This experience has been incredibly difficult and truly humbling for me. When I first received the original complaints, which both stem from toxic work relationships, I did not believe that I had violated any ethical rules in connection with the allegations, many of which, frankly, in my opinion, were outrageous. However, after reviewing the private practice allegations and realizing my mistakes, I understood my associate license would need supervision for private practice and why I would need to be specifically regulated. There were many significant aspects of the practice, such as record retention and termination of clients, that I did not consider. And I realized that I had a lot of learning to do before I seek independent licensure and possibly ever consider having a private practice again. I have reviewed the rules, and I have attempted to register for staying out of trouble. It's right now it's full, but I will continue to look for an opening spot for myself, and I'm willing to do what is necessary to show the board that I acknowledge the gravity of my mistake in running a private practice without educating myself beforehand.
Thank you. Other questions from board members? No questions? All right, this will be our time to talk amongst ourselves. We ask that you not interrupt.
I believe that first I need to move to consolidate both
allegations in one.
Is there a second?
Bailey, second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you.
So I have reviewed all the information that was provided a couple of times just to make sure that I'm not missing anything. And I wanted to move to, well, I believe that there is not substantial and convincing evidence to support the allegations from complainant. And so, however, you know, the information about the private practice and, you know, the practicing outside of the law and the retention of records is evident. And so, I move to, you know, open a complaint.
We have more discussion.
Okay. You can put that.
I'm having difficulty simply disposing of the complaints from the complaints. To me, the complaints of the complaint both complaints, that those complaints stood out for me. I don't think that they were just speaking in those terms and just malign the licensee without reason. I, I'm just asking my colleagues to help me see why that is somehow insignificant.
I'm not sure.
You're good.
Insignificant would be what I would categorize. I think there's definitely some concerning behavior, right? But does it rise to the clear and convincing of unprofessional conduct is where I struggled with our regulatory obligation. So I agree there's definitely concerns, and I'm interested, you know, in what others have to say. But so I wouldn't say insignificant, but in terms of rising to that level, that's where I had a difficult.
I agree, Mr. Ratz. I had the same just kind of feeling that the behavior and just the idea that the complaint was raised in the first place would have, you know, something was going on. I just kept reading, and I just didn't feel the investigation itself was able to uncover enough that the clear and convincing is just kind of what resonates with me, and that we just couldn't really make a strong enough argument to go there. Yeah, so that was kind of like my, you know, statement that I review, you know, all the documentation a couple of times, and just, you know, is there clear and convincing evidence for violation of rules, and I can find that. But I would like to hear from other members.
Yeah, I think it's unusual, the standage that we have for us, you know, two competing narratives and no document that supports either one. So I think that for me is why it doesn't rise to clear and convincing. But you're right. I mean, we don't usually, there's something that shows that, but it is, it's, the allegations are concerning. Other input?
So it sounds like the original complaint's not rising to that, but in terms of finding the violations for the private practice was where you were going.
Correct.
Okay. Do you want to make your motion?
So I move to find the violations for unlawful practice and retention of records.
32-5116II, as it relates to 210, 211, and 12-2297.
Mm-hmm. Is there a
second?
Second, Primer.
Roll call, please.
Kimberly Lee.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Mary Kuhner.
Aye.
Cedric Davis.
Aye.
Patricia Dobutz.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Pauline Knapp.
Aye.
Megan Kramer.
Aye.
Adelaide Sinek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Mark Shin.
Aye.
Antoine Schroeder.
Aye.
now moving into what we do with it.
Yes. So, you know, with the concerns and, you know, reading all the records and the time of the private practice and the number of clients, I am torn between, you know, disciplinary and a non-disciplinary consent.
We found the violation, so we have to move forward with the discipline.
Oh, that's right. It could just be education.
Yeah, we would, yeah. So that is actually discipline.
That's right, yeah. So I have here, I'm proposing 2 years of supervision. Once every 2 weeks, so 2 times a month for the first year. And then the remaining of the time will be at the discretion of the supervisor with the option of early release. 6 clock hours and staying out of trouble, and I believe that people are already investigating that. And then complete the Arizona Board of Behavioral Health Examiners tutorial, ethical tutorial, and actually the supervision as well.
I know that there was a verbal agreement that we wouldn't go into private practice, but Ms. Savala, would it be appropriate? Could we stipulate that there's no private practice? I know they wouldn't be able to open up the supervised private practice under the consent agreement, but if they were released early, could we put a stipulation that there's no private practice for 2 years?
Well, you could put that stipulation in, but I think the way we would create the consent agreement is she could request early release from the clinical supervision, but in order for us to maintain she can't go into private practice, that consent agreement will need to stay in place. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
I'm sorry? No early release from the consent agreement. Just from
which is not, that's not unusual. So we'd be offering a consent agreement for 24 months. She would be, I'll read it all back and see if it makes better sense. Did you say the supervisor tutorial as well, Christy?
Mm-hmm.
Just for her to have an idea of supervision expectations?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Staying out of trouble.
Just a quick question. With the continuing education for professionals, when it comes to supervisor, is there a specific spot for providing private practices?
There is not. However, as of late, we've included information in both our renewal and our clinical supervision tutorial in regards to supervised private practice to better educate.
It seems like this is something we're going to continue to run into, and you know, ultimately.
It's in the proposed rules for supervisor trainings that it has to be addressed now.
It's
in the proposed rule. However, the tutorial that they're now taking includes questions or, in regards to supervised private practice.
So supervision, I think two things that would be important to note if everybody else is okay with it, but I think focusing on documentation and professionalism as well as ethics and, you know, Arizona rules and regulations, but those were just two things that stood out to me.
I agree. So we would be offering a consent agreement for 24 months. She would be required to take the 6 CEUs and staying out of trouble or the equivalent, as well as 3 CEUs in the renewal tutorial, as well as 3 CEUs in the clinical supervision tutorial. She'd also be required to get clinical supervision twice a month. After 1 year, she would be eligible for early release at the recommendation of the clinical supervisor, but only from that supervision. We'd also put the focus would be on board statutes and rules, as well as documentation, professionalism, and behavioral health ethics. And she would also be required as a practice restriction not to be able to go into private practice. And if not signed, invited to a formal interview, and if not accepted, remanded to a formal hearing. Would that be your motion?
Is there a second?
Bailey, second.
Roll call, please.
Kimberly Lee.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Mary Coonland.
Aye.
Cedric Davis.
Aye.
Patricia Dobratz.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Holly Knapp.
Aye.
Megan Kramer.
Aye.
Adeline Zanuck.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Mark Stewart.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
Motion passes.
Okay.
Thank you both for being here. Ms. Meyer, thank you for being here as well. So conclude that matter.
I apologize. It does not conclude this matter.
Yes, I see.
So based on the investigation findings, I move to open a complaint against the clinical supervisor as it appears that she provided supervision to licensee in private practice without adequate supervision.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Ms. Meek. I apologize. Now this matter is concluded. We are going to move to agenda item 7H next, Ms. Huber. And I actually,
sorry, I hate to interrupt. I need to step out for just a minute to catch a meeting, and I was the lead on that one.
Okay. So you will be recusing or just moving away?
Abstaining.
Abstaining from this matter, Ms. Knapp. And then I will be recusing from this matter. So I will be turning it over to Dr. Bailey, and I believe we need to get the licensee on the phone.
Is this Hubert, though?
Hubert.
I'm the lead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't hear that part.
All the things just happened at once.
Mr. Bob, how do you want to proceed?
We can move forward to the next matter.
Okay.
Because I'll be right back. I just have a meeting
tomorrow. Okay. So never mind. None of that is happening except Ms. Knapp is stepping away. We've been going so smooth for 2 hours. Okay. So we will go to agenda item N, Mr. Salampa. And I believe is he present? And your attorney will be participating via phone. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. So you can go forward.
Mr.
Bauer, this is Patricia Bobrax, the board's chair. Okay, thank you so much. We are getting ready to hear Mr. Salampa's matter. He is here along with board members and board staff. And as you know, it's a public meeting, so the public is also present. And we will first hear a brief summary from board staff.
Can you hold on just for 1 second?
Mr. Barber, this is Toby Zavala. I just want to confirm we moved the case, and I believe that Ms. Herberg may still be on the phone. Is there a way that you can communicate with her just to let her know that we took a case prior to her matter?
Okay,
thank you very much. I appreciate that. Madam Chair, as member of the board, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation, ARS 32-3251-16N. Failing to comply with or violating, attempting to violate, or assisting in or abetting the violation of any provision of this chapter. This recommendation is based on the following. In 1 of 20, licensee obtained his LPC with the board. In 2 of 20, licensee opened private practice. And in 6 of 22, when reviewing another board complaint, it appeared that the private practice employed at least 24 clinicians, with at least 13 being unlicensed. Of these 13 unlicensed individuals, at least 7 of them were not licensed and did not meet any sort of the exemptions to licensure. In 8 of 22, following receipt of the board complaint, licensee obtained licensure through the Arizona Department of Health Services for both of his private practice locations. From 1/20 to 8/22, private practice was not licensed by DHS, meaning licensee could not have any unlicensed clinicians providing psychotherapy services unless they met any of the exemptions to licensure. Once licensee became aware he needed to be licensed by DHS in order to have unlicensed clinicians working for private practice, he immediately began working to obtain licensing through DHS. Licensee acknowledged his mistake and previously did not realize he needed to be licensed by DHS in order to have interns work for private practice. During the time frame, they did not hold a license with the board. Since the filing of this complaint, licensee has rectified this issue. Following a review of the investigative record, there also appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support ARS 32-3251-16M, engaging or offering to engage as a licensee in activities that are not congruent with a licensee's professional education, training, or experience. This recommendation is based on the following. During a prior board investigation, it was confirmed that licensee completed documents such as emotional support animal letters, short-term disability paperwork, and FMLA documents. Board staff presented this information for the members to consider opening a complaint in which they voted to open up a complaint for further investigation. Licensee represented the following regarding completing the above-mentioned documents. Licensee was trained during his internship to complete these types of documents and was unaware there was an issue with it. Licensee never charged extra for completing these documents. Since the filing of the board complaint, licensee has ceased writing any ESA letters or completing short-term disability or FMLA paperwork and has implemented a new practice policy prohibiting the completion of these documents. Licensee would meet with the clients a few times before completing any of these documents. Licensee would gather the information directly from the client. Board staff obtained two examples of ESA letters licensee wrote, which included the following. Licensee indicates the ESA would be necessary for part of ongoing treatment. Licensee signs with doctor in front of his name and his LPC credential after his name. Furthermore, licensee completed FMLA and or short-term disability paperwork for at least four clients, which included the following in part. Licensee described each client's symptoms and how it impacts their ability to perform job duties, and they cannot perform their duties due to their symptoms. Licensee signed two of the documents with his LPC credential listed after his signature. Licensee signed his name on another document as the healthcare provider. Licensee would sign the documents as doctor since he has a medical degree, but he is not licensed by the medical board. Licensee acknowledged that private practice does not diagnose clients with physical medical conditions. By offering to write ESA letters and complete disability or FMLA paperwork, licensee extended his boundaries of competence by indicating a client had a disability that would prevent them from completing their job duties. In fact, the board's rules and statutes do not explicitly indicate licensee is permitted to diagnose any sort of disability for psychotherapy clients, but rather that a licensee shall diagnose, assess, and treat behavioral disorders. Additionally, prior to this board complaint, licensee allowed his staff members employed at the private practice to complete these disability documents as well. And that's all I have, unless you have any questions for me.
Do board members have any questions for Ms. Zavala? All right. Mr. Barber, you and your client have up to 5 minutes to address the board.
I'm going to make a brief statement. My client will make a brief statement, and then we're going to have a bunch of questions to the board. First, I would like to thank Ms. Zavala, Ms. Argento, and the rest of the board staff for completing a very substantial investigative report. Certainly, we do not deny the issue as it relates to a violation of ARS 32-3251-16M. I think if we take just a step back and look at this holistically, this was an LAC who became an LPC and opened a private practice, and really did the best he could based on his experience as an LAC working for an LPC in private practice. And he integrated that experience into the private practice that she created. And I think it's very worth noting that none of this involved a dishonest or self-serving motive. There was no bad faith obstruction of disciplinary proceedings. He absolutely acknowledged the nature of his conduct. And additionally, both of these facilities are now state licensed, and I won't go into the details, but I think the report explains why he thought that he could have the unlicensed counselors licensed. It was not as if he was, really just employing unlicensed counselors. The second thing I would note is I know that this has come up a number of times with the board as it relates to FMLA, STDs, USA paperwork. I think it's a little bit sticky. If the threshold of determining whether or not there's a violation in terms of boundaries of competence is whether or not, as it states in the investigative report, that the board of statutes must explicitly authorize anything that a licensee does. I mean, that could get pretty wacky. I don't see anywhere in the rules that, for example, that explicitly authorizes cognitive behavioral therapy, for example. I could go on and on. It seems like every time I turn around, there's a new ketamine-assisted psychotherapy clinic, and I don't see anything in the board rules that allows for that. So if we're limiting what licenses can do based on exclusively what it is stated they're allowed to do in statute, like I said, I think it gets a bit sticky, but if he does recognize this was a problem, he stopped doing it, it's not going to happen again, and I would humbly suggest that the board offer the licensing non-compulsory disciplinary consent agreements that are allowing to complete some educational trainings and conditions so that this never happens again. Thank you, and I'm requiring a brief statement.
Thank you, Mr. Barber. Ms. Bumper?
I messed up. I take full responsibility. Is this working?
Yeah.
It echoed in my head, so I'm sorry. Anyway, I take full responsibility for my actions and apologize to the board. During my 9 years of military service, I learned not to make excuses, and I will make none now. I do ask, however, that while rendering a decision on this matter, you consider my perspective, intent, and core values. The first of my core values is that I am honest in all my dealings, and the investigative report will bear that out. At no time did I attempt to hide anything, and I've been nothing but an open book since the beginning. My core value of putting the best interests of the client first has guided my actions since the very beginning. From my perspective, everything that I have done has been with that as the top priority. My third core value, again learning the Air Force, is that I only do what my skills, knowledge, and experience allow. My policies and procedures are based on what I observed and did ever since my internship and during the time after I graduated and before being issued my LEC and during the 1,600 hours of supervised on-the-job training before becoming an LPC. I believe that this is a matter of you don't know what you don't know. And the instant that the investigator hinted that any of my practices were not in line with the board's policies, published or not, I put an immediate stop to them. Then I took the necessary measures to prevent any such violations in the future by becoming a DHS state licensed counseling agency. At this time, I believe I'm fully in compliance, not because I got caught, but because I've been educated about my mistakes that, out of ignorance, I did not know I was making. I am truly sorry for the problems this has caused.
Thank you. Board members have questions for Mr. Slompa.
Mr. Slompa. Was it your thought that any intern or any student graduating, as soon as they graduated, they could just go work anywhere?
Not that they could necessarily go work anywhere. And in my experience, what happened even with me is I did an internship, and I passed the board exam before I graduated. And then there was about 6 months while applying for my LAC where they just kept me with my same clients, and I was called a master's level counselor at the time. Mm-hmm. And then when I got my LAC, we just kind of kept going. So, I mean, it was at the same place. And in these cases, it was, my interns, they could see a client one day, they graduated before they got their LAC or temp LAC. I didn't know any better. So, that was my impression. That's how business was always done.
So that was your impression that as soon as you graduate, you can just go work as a therapist somewhere?
Well, not somewhere, but stay at the same place with your same clients until you get your license, yeah.
Okay. And then you venture into opening a rather large practice, credit practice, and I just want to know what your efforts were to kind of take on a venture like that, and what were your efforts to really educate yourself beforehand to make sure you were doing that appropriately?
So I think there might be a little misunderstanding about the large practice and stuff like that. I mean, I don't make any rules about how many hours, anybody has to work. So I mean, we have, a handful of people that are one or two clients a week or something, it's...
You're managing a lot of therapists. That's a large practice.
Well, I mean, I'm not the only LPC, but again, it's, this was one of those things where,
it started with just me, and then, you know, the other LPC, and then, you know, just kind of grew a little bit. And like I said, I mean, it didn't really seem like a lot of people. Even though it was a lot of people, it wasn't really a lot of hours, as far as what people were doing. But as far as educating myself, like I said, that's all I've been doing, is trying to educate myself on what I can and can't do. And, you know, I think one of the problems is, you know, I can read all the board rules and everything, and it just, what's not there, I don't know that I can't do it.
It is in the board rules that you have to be licensed, or, you know, it is in the rules that designate out if you're a master's level commission, what kind of, you know, arena you can work in. And licensing is very clear.
Yeah, unfortunately.
There are licensees as well, where they can work.
I understand that now. I obviously did it at the time.
Okay. And you also are a practicum site, so you're a training site plus a practicum site. And just wondering if you read all of the contracts with the schools on what students are allowed and, you know, not allowed to do, so that you're helping them as well as their practicum supervisor.
Yes, of course. I read the contracts.
Okay. So there's usually language in there that indicates what's going to happen once they graduate and what the process is for them. Have you read that as well?
I am not aware of any of the schools where it specifically said you have to fire them or something like that. No.
Okay. And then as far as FMLA paperwork and emotional support animal paperwork, what's your understanding now of why we don't do those services, why we don't perform that service of filling that out?
Honestly, I think that's probably more of a legal issue, but, again, I get it. You know, I understand the chain of command. As far as my thought process goes with that, is if you don't want to do it, I don't have a problem with that. It's not like I was making any money off it. I just, I don't know exactly why you, don't want people to do it, other than, you know, clearly, you think it's above people's scope to do those.
So you just discontinue those services in light of knowing I probably should if I'm moving forward?
Well, I discontinued them because it appeared in an investigation that you guys didn't want me to do them. So that day, I said, we're done. I'm not doing them anymore.
Thank you.
Just one point of clarification. I know that you now have the entities licensed by AZDHS, but I want to make sure that there's also an understanding that there's AZDHS rules, right, that the entity now has to follow, but also any licensed professional still needs to follow BBHE rules. So that doesn't lessen the obligation to the board.
Yeah. Yes, of course. There are a few more rules. It's not less.
Correct. Okay. That's kind of clear. Any other questions from board members?
Are you licensed to practice medicine anywhere?
No. It's not that I lost it, I just never applied.
Any other questions? This will be our time to talk amongst ourselves. We ask that you not interrupt. Dr. Bailey, are you leading this one?
I am leading. I think there's a lot to discuss here. You know, first, you know, just talking about kind of the boundaries of competence, you know, some of the reasons why is that feedback from me? Sorry. One of the, you know, I was going through the FMLA paperwork, and I've seen it, you know, when it's presented, you know, to me, and I have to explain to my clients why I can't fill that out. And even in the examples that we got to read through, you know, there's sections in there that, you know, list what's the medication. Well, if you're not the prescribing doctor, we don't list the medication just by report of the client. The paperwork, you know, then it indicates or it presumes that I'm the one that prescribed that. You know, and then there's other, you know, issues as far as, you know, even if we were to go through all of that,
we have to then release them to go back to work and return to work, and we don't have any competence at all to know if they can actually do their job. Like, I mean, it's, so even if we were to move forward and fill out all of these, you know, line items that don't exactly represent what we're treating, we can't even then do the release. So it gets us into a significant bind the way the paperwork is developed.
Hi, Adam.
Yes.
Otherwise, I'll forget. But I think that was a great way to articulate it. And to piggyback on that, is also we are providing behavioral health services, right? And so we have an informed consent for psychotherapy services. We have a treatment plan with psychotherapy goals, right? We are documenting behavioral health services. So there's also the role that we take on in addition to competence, right? And so that's our role versus our role to evaluate and fill out those forms.
No.
So, I understand because sometimes, you know, in the past, you contact whoever's sending those forms and they say, oh, anybody can do it. Right? Mm-hmm. So we just have to go back to, you know, your scope of work and say, you know your license, or you should know your license better than anybody else.
Yeah.
So I understand the particular limits sometimes.
I do agree that there's a significant mental, you know, just to go on record, there's a significant mental health report in a lot of that documentation. And so, you know, our best practice would be to collaborate with psychiatrists, collaborate with doctors, and offer the opportunity to collaborate to give our feedback on what's happening mental health or behavioral health-wise. And then that way they could actually fill out the form appropriately and with the right credentials. So I think moving forward, if that is not, if the process of filling out these forms is not revamped systemically, but, you know, or organically from wherever they come from, you know, that is how we can have our input and help providers adequately fill out those forms for their patients. Just my thoughts there. So I do feel we have substantial evidence to back this allegation.
I have a different take on this one. I do think it depends on the circumstance. You know, if it's a form that cites to a federal statute that defines healthcare provider, then I think that's pretty clear. But I think it's really when all that's needed under the Americans with Disabilities Act, for example, is to explain to an employer, I have this disability and these are my limitations. And I think an LPC can do that. Say, you know, I'm diagnosing you with obsessive compulsive disorder, and these are the things that might limit you in your workplace. And I think by adding that extra, because I don't see anything that prohibits it, I think by saying you really ought to talk to a psychiatrist or a psychologist, often these people are being treated by a psychologist or a psychiatrist, and that's going to put a boundary that may end up preventing them from working altogether.
In all of our codes of ethics, so it's very clear, though, in terms of value to roles versus providing health services and psychotherapy roles, and that's why I brought up it's a very different person that's working possibly for an entity that is evaluating for disability, and they may be an LPC, but they also have this role and this training, and this is what they're doing, and they do fall within that scope of that paperwork, versus somebody who is providing behavioral health services under the scope of the behavioral health services license to a client who is contracting in an informed consent for psychotherapy services and all of that. That's where I wanted to also draw that distinction.
Yeah.
Because there's also the scope of practice and our ethical obligation. We're providing psychotherapy services. My relationship with you is very different than if you come into my office and I am doing an evaluation, right? It's just a very different practice, and that's what we license, and that's what the role that him and
I agree. I mean, both, especially when you're saying more mental health issues in the workplace, so people are requesting ethical aid specifically for depression, specifically for anxiety, or it's just for a different landscape. So I think specifically as a college where we are right now, but I think that we have a place to go because, you know, it's just been a thing in that area where we say we have
to
be up in LA because of
that. And I think we ought to just say out loud, it's happening. Like,
caseload is someone who's got someone who's licensed by the school probably filling out those forms. It's happening. So I don't know whether this is something we can agendize to get more to talk about outside the context of this case at some point. Because I do think they're different. You know, having a specific form for FMLA leave that's citing to you know, federal codes, that's something very specific. But the Americans with Disabilities Act doesn't require that. They just require you to explain what you've got to your employer. You may not even need a note from anybody. And so oftentimes therapists are signing these things. And I think, you know, we may have to get into looking at the consents. That's an important thing. But for me on this one, I'll just say it does not rise to your parents.
Well, I think what both of you said, it is happening, because I know my granddaughter, several of her roommates and stuff. There's young people out there getting these disabilities signed off by their counselors, and they are getting that to their employers, and they're getting assistance based on their problem out there doing that.
It is all
doesn't make it right.
Right, and I feel very uncomfortable. Well, I feel uncomfortable with the idea of disabling someone. Like, that's what that paperwork says I'm doing, is I am disabling them from working. And that doesn't fall under our rules anywhere that we're allowed to do that, nor do I want.
And I think it most commonly comes up not where we're actually saying this person can't work at all, but we're saying this is what the person needs in order to be able to work in the workplace. And so it's actually, we're enabling them to have the most productive version of that employment relationship. And I think the vast majority of these requests, that's what's actually happening, is they're saying, you know, here's what I need in order to succeed in my job. It might be an earlier shift, or it might be whatever it is, but that's what most of them are. And so in the absence of something clear saying that you can't, maybe looking at consents is important.
And our code of ethics. Yeah. Madam Chair, I'm actually a little troubled by this conversation, for many reasons. One, because it's not a legal issue, it's an ethics issue, and it's a role issue. And I'm not a clinician, but it's always been, the presentation, I don't want to say opinion, but I want to say presentation of our board, that you don't write letters on behalf of your clients. And there's reasons. That's not your responsibility. You are the therapist. And I think it's really important, and I think Dr. Bailey said it, and I've said it multiple times in various presentations and things I've done, that as a clinician, you're awarded the ability to assess, diagnose, and treat, but you can't physically disable people. So, it's imperative we go on the record and say that. We can absolutely put it on for a formal, you know, discussion later on, but I think that is a very, not a good area we want to go down. But with that said, I also want the board members to know that we take these on a case by case when they come in. I can't mention other cases, but we've had cases in the last few months where we've given a letter of concern or an NDCA just to kind of make them aware of this. This case actually came to a disciplinary level based on the other conduct that was occurring, as well as him allowing his staff to do it. So I think I've heard that we put it on for a further discussion, but I think it's really important for the public to understand, as a clinician, the code of ethics, I don't believe, allows it.
This particular situation is further complicated because the SEC really does have training for that. And although we may not be licensed in addition to the training as a doctor, the training is certainly certified. It complicates even more. In my opinion, it is up to him to restrict himself.
think I would respectfully disagree, and just for somebody who's licensed in a completely different profession, that it's even more instilled in me and important for me to draw that line with clients that I don't give legal advice. And in this role, I'm a psychotherapist providing behavioral health services, and I can't cross this line.
Which is exactly what I was saying. The licensee has to discipline himself or herself.
Yeah. Sorry, Doc. Thank you.
Well, and actually, in this case, I was just going to say, I think it does rise. When I looked at the examples, again, there are line items that are filled out that would allude that they were provided.
I agree.
And so I was basing it off of what we're seeing as far as what actually was completed. You get a super good point.
So we have it on future agenda for further discussion at macro level, and then bring it back to this case specifically.
And secondly, I think we have plenty of evidence that shows that we have allowed an unlawful practice. And when I hear, oh, they only worked a couple of hours, you know, one client is 1 hour. That's their whole therapy experience, is their 1 hour a week or 1 hour a month or every other week or whatnot. So the idea of how many client hours that feels not pertinent to talking about, you know, maybe reasons why we didn't think to look at all the rules on how to open a practice as significant as being a practicum site, and secondly, then a training site. And with two levels of licensure, or two levels of experience, one level of licensure, and there's a lot going on whenever we are taking interns as well as then associates, and to not put in due diligence to find out how to actually do that, it feels like a
Yeah, that's my big thing in a lot of these is, this is what you want to do, then you take the time to go find out, what do I have to do to be able to do this ethically and legally?
I would suggest given the conversation that if you're going to make a motion to find violations, that would make two separate motions just because there may be different
voting. Yeah, absolutely. I move that we find for violation of allowing unlawful practice, ARS 3232-5116N.
Can we have a roll call, please?
Second. Kramer.
Oh, sorry. I apologize. Yeah. Can we have a roll call, please?
Camilla Berry.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Lynn Kunad.
Aye.
Cedric Davis.
Aye.
Patricia Dobatz.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Megan Kramer.
Aye.
Adam Samuk.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Mark Shane.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
Secondly, I find that we find for ARS 3232-5116M, boundaries of confidence.
Is there a second?
Drop a second.
Roll call, please.
Kimberly Daly.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
It's a vote one way or another.
Yeah, and I'll come back to it.
Can we do that? Yes, you can abstain. Should go with it.
Aye.
Nay.
Mary Kunad.
Aye.
Cedric Davis.
Aye.
Patricia Dobatz.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Madam Chair, it's really important. I'm staying, you're on a fence. You, as a board member, you have to make a decision one way or the other. Your abstain would be if you're not in the room for a vote.
Nay.
Megan Kramer.
Aye.
Adelisa Meek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Mark Shin.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
Both motions carry. So we found for both violations. And Dr. Bailey, in terms of moving forward, suggestions?
I suggest that we consider a consent agreement for 2 years with a graduate level course in ethics. I would suggest, and then the 12-hour supervision CEU course be retaken and in Arizona in person. That way we get all the nuances of Arizona, very different, can have discussions with other participants about their experiences, their questions. It's very different than just going through an online, read the presentation of minimum standards and take a test. And that's kind of where we get the richest experience for being a better
better supervisor for our state. So I would suggest that. And I would suggest a practice restriction to not supervise for the entire consent agreement time. I know that might be woven in, but if there's an early release or anything like that, I think there needs to be some time to kind of really reorganize and figure out how to do this, how to be a good supervisor and make sure all of the rules are investigated. I'm open to some other suggestions or criticisms of what I've suggested.
Is there anything further we can do with the unlawful practice part? Because I feel like these cases are falling into the, you know, we don't know what we don't know. Well, being a licensed professional at the level, you should know to at least ask for legal advice at minimum. So, you know, there's this level, in my opinion, of the willful ignorance in some respects. So is there anything that we can do on that side? Because that's fine and everything. And I know now it's a few chance to be.
I know.
That tie does, but like, just some level of something we can do to focus on, you know, don't open a business if you're not understanding the full aspects of the business. And, you know, it's more than just supervision, in my opinion. It's just being the core owner of the business and not understanding, because you have your license, you went through your process, but, you know, as a business guy, you can't just open up the business and think, oh, that's fine. There's other something else there, too. It's not easier to open your own business. It's harder. You should know that. You should be curious enough to figure that out. It's fine.
I really appreciate those thoughts, because you made me think that now we have a lot of clinicians that also think they can go into practice, and if they become supervisors and don't do their due diligence, we have perpetuated a cycle that the licensee is now saying he was victim to. So I don't know that there's anything we can do, but I think I just needed to agree with you verbally that we have other issues here with that. Isn't there a course on how to open your own business or something like that? There's some private practice, like,
is it required?
No, but I mean, I think it goes back to also, I mean, how many business owners outside of this profession fail, right? Or don't do it the right way either. So, which courses are, you know, that's difficult to figure out too, and that's where it's on, I think, a licensee to know our standard of practice. And so to own a business and operate within our standard of practice, you've got to make sure you cover your day. I don't know how to do it any other way, and it's seeking out those courses, it's seeking out legal advice, it's seeking out those things. Anything else we'd like to add to the consent agreement? Yes. So we'll be offering the licensee a consent agreement for 24 months. He'd be required to take a 3-credit graduate level course in behavioral health ethics in the first 12 months. He'd also be required to take 12 clinical supervision hours in Arizona and in person within the first 12 months. And in the remaining 12 months, he will be on probation, and there'll be a practice restriction that he will be unable to clinically supervise anybody. If not signed, he'd be invited to a formal interview, and if not accepted, remanded to a formal hearing.
Possibility of early release.
I think I heard Dr. Bailey said she would prefer for 24 months he not provide clinical supervision. My thought, I was addressing the issue of not kind of supervising. We had a lot of clinicians who supervised inappropriately. And, I think that would give ample time to realize and gain all the information we need to make sure nothing like that happens, including reading interns' practicum-site contracts. I have a few of those, and they might not be the schools he's working with, but they're all very clear on helping the student know what's next. That was my thoughts.
payment to this. So moved. Is there a second?
Potter, second.
Roll call, please.
Kimberly Bailey.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Mary Cunon.
Aye.
Cedric Davis.
Aye.
Patricia Dobutz.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Megan Kramer.
Aye.
Adeline Simuk.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Mark Shin.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
Motion carries. All right, Mr. Sampa, thank you for being here. Mr. Bauer, thank you for being available via phone. This will conclude this matter. And Mr. Bauer, I don't believe we're ready to hear your next matter yet, so we will be in touch shortly. Mike's back on. We are back on the record at 10:52. For the record, Matt has rejoined us, and we are going to go back now to agenda item number 7H, Ms. Hubert, and we're going to try this again. I am going to recuse from the matter, handing it over to Dr. Bailey, and I believe we need to get the licensee and attorney on the phone.
Welcome to Lumen Conferencing. Please enter your passcode. Thank you. Your passcode is confirmed. When you hear the tone, you will be the third person to join the meeting.
Here to hear the Hubrick case. Is the complainant here?
Yeah.
Ms. Sabians?
Oh, not the complainant. No.
So just to clarify, we have on the phone Ms. Hubrick and Mr. Barber. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Is the is the complainant for this matter here? Okay. Okay, so would we just then go to the... So can we please hear a brief summary from the board staff?
Following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation, ARS 32-3251-16-II, as it relates to ARS 13-3620, duty to report abuse. And ARS 32-3251-16-Q, failing or refusing to maintain adequate records or behavioral health services provided to client. This recommendation is based on the following. From 8-9-21 to 12-15-21, licensee provided direct behavioral health services to client. Client's goals included processing trauma, increasing coping skills, maintaining healthy relationships and boundaries, and medication management. A 9-21-21 progress note indicated client and licensee discussed a history of client's abuse without any explicit statements about a sexual assault. This note completed by licensee failed to include any mention of possibly reporting this incident to the police or any sort of information regarding when the sexual assault occurred. A 9-29-21 progress note indicated licensee discussed with client how she used to be prior to the sexual assault. A 10-8-21 case management note indicated licensee contacted mother to discuss the mandated report regarding the sexual assault. During an investigative interview, licensee represented that mother was the one to initially report the sexual assault, and licensee failed to document this conversation she had with mother due to being inundated with work and slipping her mind to document the interaction. Licensee failed to document anywhere in the clinical record her report to the police regarding the sexual assault. Furthermore, there is no record or indication that a police report was made by licensee other than her representation during the board's investigation. Licensee failed to make a police report for at least a week following the sexual assault disclosure. Even more concerning is that licensee represented at the time she was made aware of the sexual assault. She believed it was reportable, yet failed to make the report immediately. Licensee had made reports regarding sexual assault in the past, but this case was different due to the amount of burnout she was feeling at that time. Despite licensee representing representing she has made reports about sexual abuse in the past. Licensee represents she did not feel supported at agency and attempted to seek guidance as were not given much guidance on how to report client sexual assault. Agency had a policy in place regarding the mandated reporting of suspected abuse. Furthermore, licensee signed a supervision agreement indicating her understanding that she would bring forward any concerns to her supervisor, included suspected child abuse. Additionally, a 6-3-21 group supervision session that licensee attended included a discussion around mandated reporting of child abuse and the relevant statute around mandatory reporting of child abuse. Licensee, in fact, should have immediately reported the sexual assault to police or DCS. A number of supervision notes indicated licensee expressed feelings of burnout. Licensee acknowledged not documenting some of her outreach attempts to other clients due to burnout and lack of support of agency. Licensee did not document her outreach attempts to various clients, mother's initial report of the sexual assault, and her eventual report to the police. And that's all I have, unless you have any questions for me.
Thank you, Ms. Ibarra. Does anyone have any questions for board staff? Can the licensee and her counsel introduce themselves for the record?
Good morning, Barbara. Attorney for the licensee, Lauren Rubrick, who is present telephonically.
Thank you very much. And you both have up to 5 minutes to address the board.
Yeah, I'd just like to make a brief statement and then, of course, make my client available for any questions the board staff may have. I'd like to thank the board staff. I'm sorry, that the board may have. I'd like to thank the board staff, particularly Jimena and her due diligence in completing this investigative report. We certainly do not deny that there exists enough evidence for violations to be found. I would note that this was licensee's first disciplinary offense to be brought to the board. One of the indicators in R461001 to arguably possibly number 7 of the reply in this case. Again, as Ms. Ibarra noted, the licensee was at a point in her professional life where she was feeling extreme burnout, was not feeling that she was getting the necessary support that she needed. However, she certainly recognizes what she has done. In an effort to rectify that, she has, at this point, enrolled in Florida, where she's completing her education in school. She is she's completing 16 hours of interviews on her own through Elias to include, among others, ethical and ethics for marriage and family therapists, 2.25 hours. I would humbly submit that we would like to be given the opportunity to receive a non-disciplinary consent agreement that would require her to complete certain terms as it relates to mandatory reporting. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Does that conclude? Do you have anything for the board?
Mr. Barber, did you want your client to present anything?
No, I just wanted to make sure that available for any questions that the board may have.
Thank you, Mr. Barber. Does any board members have any questions for the complainant? Or his counsel, her counsel? Ms. Knapp, I think you're leading us in some discussion regarding this case.
I am. Thank you. So after taking a look at the case and all of the documents, I think we have definitely clear and convincing evidence to be able to find a violation that is of unprofessional conduct is based on ARS 32-32-5116-5. As it relates to ARS 13-36-20, so that's around the failure to report abuse. It's, the evidence is clear there, and to find a violation of ARS 32-32-5116-G, failing or refusing to maintain adequate records of behavioral health services provided to the clients.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. That was my, it looks like a G, but it's a Q. My bad there. A Q. So, I mean, there definitely is clear and convincing evidence to show both of these things. So I would like to make a motion.
Can I ask if there's just any discussion? Is that your motion? Okay. Is there a second? All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? Thank you. Motion carries. And would you lead us into what to do with this?
Yeah, so looking at that, kind of some of the things that I was tossing around and obviously would love everyone's feedback was to do a disciplinary consent agreement with some of the following requirements. I had some concerns. It seems like there were sort of a lot of basics missing for this client in the information, not only surrounding documentation, but also client follow-up, best practice and care of that client, and then also how to utilize supervision with her supervisor. There was also a lot of discussion on how she was feeling. So, you know, vicarious trauma and burnout. She's only been in the field a very short time. And we all know this is a really important time to kind of build our bubble. That's what I like to say, right? Learn some of those protective skills and factors. And she seems to be struggling in those areas. So I was thinking that due to that, we would recommend weekly supervision with a clinical supervisor, just so that she can really be catching some of that stuff or processing beforehand, before it builds up to be an issue of burnout. I'd like to offer her the staying out of trouble class or some sort of ethics and law for 6 hours, 3 hours of documentation education, in education surrounding treatment planning and best practice, and that to relate directly to that there was an assessment that began in this whole process where the sexual assault was disclosed. It didn't seem that it was caught at that time either, and that it was part of the treatment planning process, and it would appear that it was in there, but that, again, there was no reporting of the disclosure and no methodology attached to how that would be addressed. And then I would ask that everyone just kind of consider maybe any sort of services that we could recommend or offer surrounding the vicarious trauma and processing of what is happening with her clients.
Is that 12 months of the weekly supervision?
Yeah, and then I would, and then maybe, you know, depending on how the supervisor was feeling.
Okay.
About her.
Okay, so 2 year consent agreement, supervision for weekly for the first year, and then recommendation of the supervisor from there forward?
Yes. Okay. I think so. I think this is a real learning opportunity, and we can offer a learning opportunity. I would think that early release after the first year. Absolutely.
Right now, for the focus for the supervision, I have board statutes and rules, documentation, burnout, mandated reporting, and self-care.
Ms. Barr, there's a statement at the beginning that the licensee is currently employed in a place that does not provide behavioral health. Do we know if she's in a situation to even carry out a consent agreement?
I think that would be a question for the licensee, but I don't believe the place that she currently works provides behavioral health. With that
said, they do not.
What, Mr. Barber?
They do not. I just wanted to get on there.
Oh, okay. With that said, you know, it depends on the board members. You could still offer the CA, and basically the CA would stay in place until she was in a position where she was providing direct client contact and could get that clinical supervision.
Thank you.
And it doesn't matter. Just for clarification, so essentially the CA would be like sort of Halloween, in abeyance or purgatory until she re-engaged clients?
Well, not exactly. So what would happen if the members voted on this? The consent agreement would be in place. She would be required to complete everything that she was able to complete, such as the education. But because she's not providing direct client contact, she could ask for tolling on the clinical supervision. And then once she's in a position to provide direct client contact, it would then go into place.
Thank you, Ms. Obama.
And I don't know if we're able to do this, but I think it really speaks to what we see often is making an expectation that all of her cases are staffed. There's not that picking of which cases she'd like to staff, that the supervisor is addressing all the cases just to catch anything that might be outside of her awareness. Can I ask one clarifying question? I heard the six CEUs and staying out of trouble were equivalent. I heard three CEUs and behavioral health documentation. And then was there an additional three CEUs for treatment planning and best practice?
Best practice, okay.
All right, so what I have captured here is that we would be offering the licensee consent agreement for 24 months. Within the first 12 months, she would be required to complete the six CEUs in staying out of trouble or equivalent, as well as three CEUs in behavioral health documentation and three CEUs in treatment planning and best practice. In addition, she would be required to get weekly supervision. The focus of that would be burnout, board statutes and rules, mandated reporting, self-care, as well as review of caseload for cases to be reviewed during supervision. She would be able to be released after the year, if all of the stipulations have been completed at the recommendation of her supervisor. If not signed, she'd be invited to a formal interview, and if not accepted, remanded to a formal hearing. Would that be your motions?
Yes, except under the supervision, was documentation included in there?
I think I said it out loud, but I didn't write it. So, yes, documentation.
That would be my motion.
Is there a second?
Read the second.
And I think I need a roll call.
Kimberly Green.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Mary Cunard.
Aye.
Cedric Davis.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Polly Knapp.
Aye.
Megan Kramer.
Aye.
Adelison Meek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios. Mark Shin. Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
Okay, motion carries. That will conclude this matter.
I have one more item for the matter.
Sure.
I just wanted it added to the record as a part of the discussion or comments around this matter. One of the items that we're talking about actually in reference to the complainant is their understanding that reporting is needed to made or legally needs to be made by the person who heard it first and only that person. And I just want to offer some clarification that in the duty to warn laws, which is 13.36.20, it does state that it's any person who reasonably believes that a minor is or has been a victim of physical injury, abuse, or child abuse, or a reportable offense of neglect, shall immediately report or cause reports to be made of this information to a peace officer or DCS. So I just wanted to clarify that for the public, that it is not, you know, the supervisor is responsible also for making those reports if they feel the reports have not been made directly. And I don't know if that happened or not in this case, but I did absolutely want to make sure that we are putting that on record as understanding.
Thank you, Ms. Knapp. Okay, this case is concluded. Ms. Kubrick and Mr. Barber, thank you for participating, and you will hear from board staff.
Thank you so much to the board and to board staff. Have a great day and weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Do you want to keep going?
Okay. I have Regine. We're going to go to 7A, Brennan Burkhart. Is the complainant in this matter, Ms. Watson, present? Or is the licensee present? For 7A, Brennan Burkhart.
All right.
We'll hear a brief summary from board staff. this matter is before the board for review, consideration, and possible action regarding accepting the proposed signed consent agreement for the voluntary surrender of the professional license. Since 7 of 21 licensees been licensed with the board as an LAC, the board staff received a complaint on September 1st that alleged that licensee was involved in an inappropriate relationship with a client by outlining the following in part. On 8/31/22, client received information from her client regarding licensee and her client. Licensee saw client inpatient setting this year, and their last in-office was 5/5/22. Wife suspected they were too close during the time and described a session in which licensee held client for 10 minutes as he cried. They were receiving couples counseling or family counseling with licensee. It was reported there are numerous screenshots of FaceTime calls and various hours and days of recent interactions between client and licensee. The complainant was given licensee's phone number and noted the street licensee's home was on. Wife could verify that client returned from drunk and high from that address. A review of the clinical records showed that from approximately 10/21 to 5/22, licensee provided therapy services to client. Client's diagnosis included the following: alcohol use disorder, cannabis use disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, unspecified depressive disorder, and post-traumatic stress disorder. A review of the phone communications between licensee and client showed the following: between 1/22 and 3/22, there were approximately 15 instances of phone calls. Between 6/22 and 9/22, there was approximately 273 instances of phone calls. Although not extensive, there were several text messages between licensee and client that do not appear to be in regards to therapeutic services. After further conversation with the complainant did report that she did enter into a sexual relationship with the client after a couple months of termination with the client. We have before you a consent agreement for the voluntary surrender of the licensee's license, and this would be a V violation engaging in any sexual conduct between a licensee and a client or a formal client. And I'm asking for the board members to consider accepting that signed consent agreement.
Thank you, Ms. Zavala. Do board members have any questions? Mr. Charles, I believe this was yours to read.
Yeah, and anything less than the consent agreement probably would have necessitated a longer discussion, but voluntary surrender, I think, is adequate. One quick question, Director Zavala, and I know we've addressed this before, but should they decide to want to reapply, what's the process again?
So that's really important, because in the state of Arizona, they technically could reapply tomorrow. There's no statute that says they can't apply for a certain period of time. With that said, if an individual were to reapply, that would be considered an investigative matter, and that would be information that would be brought before the board to determine whether or not they were safe and competent to practice.
Good to know. So with that, I've moved it.
And for the public, a voluntary surrender is considered a revocation for the license.
Is there a second?
Trotter, second.
Roll call, please. Kimberly Bailey.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Mary Kruna.
Aye.
Cedric Davis.
Aye.
Patricia Dobatz.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Polly Knapp.
Aye.
Megan Kramer.
Aye.
Adelisa Meek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Mark Shin.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
Motion carries. Thank you.
We'll go to 7B, Dondra Campbell. Is anybody here on that matter? Whenever you're ready.
Madam Chair, members of the board, this matter is before you for the board members to consider issuing a cease and desist. This is in regards to a complaint that we received on 9/2/22. We received this from a charter school. That charter school had employed Mr. Campbell as an LPC, and he had been providing services to the students at that school. One of the social workers that worked for the school was applying for a grant for monies to provide therapeutic services to the kiddos that attended that school, and at that time, that grant was denied because the individuals that accepted that grant had verified that Mr. Campbell was not licensed by our board. After communication back and forth, the school was able to provide board staff a fraudulent, altered license from our board. Specifically, it had our old board chair, Chip Coffey, on it, the issue date of 7/1/19, expiration of 5/31/24, so it was altered. with that said, after further review, we did find out that the license number that was used actually did belong to one of our licensees. So board staff did reach out to that licensee just to make them aware. We couldn't do anything else other than to make them aware that their license had been used. And other than that, I do know that the school reported it to the police department, and at this point, Mr. Campbell has not returned any of my calls or emails that I have sent him. So we have attached a cease and desist order that is attachment number 2. And basically that cease and desist order will be sent to him. And if, you know, he were to continue to do that, then we would send that over to the Attorney General's office. And that's all I have.
And we need just a motion to issue the letter.
A cease and desist order, yes.
All right. Thank you very much. Are there any other questions from board members?
I guess I have a question on process. So we generally do the cease and desist without authority to it, even though we had evidence of fraudulent use already.
Forward it to, I'm sorry.
Forward it to the Attorney General's office. After.
Why do we
do that process?
We typically don't. You know, and this is something rare that we see before our board, and obviously very concerning.
Yeah. Just because I thought, you know, having a copy of the license was enough to have it probably do the cease and desist later and to Attorney General's office, I guess, because of our concerns.
But. Yeah, we usually wait until they basically violate the cease and desist, but I do, like, as I mentioned, I do know in this particular case that the police and many other entities are involved in this prosecution.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Mr. Charles, raise again.
Similar, because of police involvement, I feel a lot better about this and our actions were just.
Bailey, second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Do we need a roll call? We're going to do a roll call, please.
Sure.
Can we do a roll call, please?
Kimberly Bailey?
Aye.
Robert Charles?
Aye.
Mary Kunon?
Aye.
Cedric Davis?
Aye.
Patricia Dobraps?
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan?
Aye.
Pauline Knapp?
Aye.
Megan Kramer?
Aye.
Adelisa Meek?
Aye.
Diane Palacios?
Aye.
Mark Shin?
Aye.
Antoine Schroeder?
Aye.
Thank you. Next, we'll go to 7D, Ellen Day. Is the applicant present? All right, Ms. Day, we're first going to hear a brief summary from board staff.
Madam Chair, members of the board, an applicant for licensure must meet the requirements of ARS 32-3275A6, which includes the following: not have committed any act or engaged in any conduct that would constitute grounds for disciplinary action against a licensee pursuant to this chapter. Following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation: ARS 32-3251-16K, engaging in any conduct or practice that is contrary to recognized standards of ethics in the behavioral health profession. As it relates to the following sections of the ACA Code of Ethics, A4B, Personal Values, and A9B, Protecting Clients. This recommendation is based on the following. On January 3, 2022, the board received applicant's LAC application. Within her application, she answered yes to the background questions regarding prior terminations from a behavioral health agency. Applicant represented she was terminated from Agency 2 due to using prompts when dealing with maladaptive behaviors, such as physically moving a client away from the door who was attempting to elope. Applicant represented she was terminated from Agency 3 for contacting the mother of a client to notify them of another co-worker's departure from Agency 3. Applicant's personnel records with Agency 2 included the following. On 11-11-21, applicant was terminated. On 11-10-21, corrective action indicated the following. Applicant used inappropriate language with a client. Applicant grabbed the client with force to get them off the table. Applicant was observed being overly forceful and prompting to evoke behaviors on a client. And a mother reported applicant was overly stern with a client. Applicant's personnel records with Agency 3 included the following. A 12-11-19 email noted, applicant physically grabbed the client by the leg and dragged them across the carpet to get something out of their mouth. a 2-12-20. On 2-12-20, applicant was placed on a performance improvement plan for patterns of speaking poorly about clients and or family in front of clients, such as making a statement that a mother should not have kept reproducing. A 5-29-20 email noted applicant made a racial comment that a person was perpetuating their own stereotype. On 2-19-21, applicant was terminated for failing to comply with company rules and the handbook. During an investigative interview, applicant represented the following. She acknowledged making a comment that a mother should not have kept reproducing, but there was no malicious intent. Applicant made this comment in terms of mother continuing to have children who all had autism. Clients were nearby when she made this comment, but she spoke in a low tone. Applicant could not recall physically dragging a client across the ground, but may have grabbed the client to remove something from their mouth to avoid a choking hazard. Applicant did make a racially derogatory comment in front of multiple co-workers and reported it was meant to be a joke. Applicant was not thinking rationally when she messaged a client's mother through her personal Facebook. She acknowledges the comments she made about the mother and the racial comment were not appropriate. It is concerning that applicant physically grabbed clients on multiple occasions, while the ACA Code of Ethics outlined it is a counselor's responsibility to protect clients from any physical, emotional, or psychological trauma. Furthermore, on at least two separate occasions, applicant failed to display or consider racial or cultural sensitivity by making inappropriate comments in the workplace. That's all I have unless you have any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carver. Are there any questions? You would have up to 5 minutes to address the board as a licensee.
Thank you. Very simply, first off, that I acknowledge I made a number of mistakes. The two previous jobs in question were in the ABA field as brand new to the field, and I made the mistake of not advocating for myself when I felt like I was not receiving the adequate support. I am no longer working in the ABA field. I'm working as a behavioral health counselor with teenagers in a one-on-one setting. So it's a very different environment. I have much more support. I meet with my supervisor every other week for supervision. And she's always open to any questions or concerns that I may have. I'm also open to whatever disciplinary or non-disciplinary actions the board decides to take against me. Really, working with teenagers is kind of like, it's my dream. So I will do whatever is necessary to continue working in the position that I'm currently in.
Are there questions for the applicant? Any questions? All right, this will be our time to talk amongst ourselves. We ask that you not interrupt. Mr. Palacios?
Yes. So our clients come to us because they're struggling in people support. And I have great concerns that a client clients deserve the utmost respect, empathy, and positive regard. If they're having an experience with someone who recognizes that they need help and they need help and to be encouraged, the concern is that respect, compassion, empathy are not being provided to them, the vulnerable clients being called up into the situation. And so I want to thank my colleagues for bringing this up. Thank you.
It was concerning that it happened at two different employers too, so I hope you're right, Don, that this would be kind of a turnaround, right? We've seen a pattern of behavior and now it's rose to coming before the board, so hopefully this is the time to do something different.
Yeah, and although, you know, it's like different types of, I guess, services, human health, right, that the same standards apply. Just changing the scenario, you know, or the agency might not be enough, but I can still be more aware of that.
Go ahead.
After reviewing all of that, to open a complaint. Professional conduct based upon ARS 32-32-75-86, as well as lack of cultural sensitivity and inappropriate client contact, ARS 32-32-51-16-K, engaging in a conduct or practice that is contrary to recognized standards of ethics in the behavioral health profession or that constitutes a danger to the health, welfare, or safety of the client as it relates to the following sections of ACA Code Ethics: A4B, personal values, A9B, protecting clients.
Is there a second?
Got a second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Suggestions of how to move forward?
I'm very torn. And so, is it agreement enough to deny a license? Or is it something that the licensee is going to learn from and have a consent agreement that it's followed? And so I would like to hear from my colleagues since I have been stirring around in my head and don't quite have a solid decision.
I think we have a much better chance of protecting the public and rehabilitating if we have a consent agreement in place that gives those resources than if we were to deny the application and kind of let her be on her own, because she could continue where she is. That would just be my...
licensees to take a course in cultural sensitivity or cultural diversity or something like that that I support their papers.
What do you mean in your life? Another one. Now you know it's a good
thing.
Unconscious bias.
Yes, cultural humility. And I really appreciated that course because I hadn't thought of cultural sensitivity in that way prior to that. Of course, I know something about being treated in ways that do not feel comfortable. So I can imagine how other people feel.
And I think that is the supervision follows that, because you take a class and, you know, whatever, if, you know, a place and time. But then if the supervision, reinforces that, then, you know, I think you have a better chance of
understanding, practicing in a better way.
Even just the other day, dealing with something in my workplace, and a person had a difficult, very difficult day, and the coworker said something that, I guess, before a pop. And I heard myself open my mouth and say, "Oh, no pop." But we don't. And if I don't stand up for it, then who will?
I don't even know if the graduate courses call it cultural, because it's still, but I know that you have to use a lot of it. And so keeping that angle is really important to supervision. I think burnout, because it sounds like sometimes some of the behaviors that they should talk about burnout and frustration. Not in supervision, addressing cultural humility.
Yeah. Self as therapist and just kind of that reflection process too in terms of the population that we're working with, and is it appropriate for you and are you comfortable? And I think some of these things came possibly from being working with the clientele or in an environment that wasn't. And so if that had been addressed in supervision in terms of what am I comfortable working with, what do I like, what am I having challenges with, then that would be appropriate in supervision.
The applicant has found the population that is particularly
likely. So I think that that's important. I'm sorry, Chip Brass, can you capture yours a little bit better than that? her self-development as a therapist and her professional self. What speaks to her? What's challenging for her? What is she staying within that scope?
I also think, unless you guys disagree, I think unconscious bias is more specific than cultural sensitivity, and sometimes it's difficult to address unconscious bias, but when I see some of this stuff that's really, it's not even like there's some overt stuff happening, and I think that would be critical to include in the supervision.
And 3 hours in cultural humility and 3 in unconscious bias. I mean, I think there's CEs in both, too, so we could do something like that.
I would almost think of the population she's working with, even at bullying, because that is part of bullying in the workplace. I'm working with teenagers who pick up all bullying instantaneously. So if you're role modeling that in front of them, you're perpetuating bullying in a population that deals with it and is suffering from it. And so how does that play out if you're unconsciously bullying people in the workplace?
I like what Dr. Hennigan just said, because the concern I'm having is it's great that she's found the population that she likes to serve, but the impressionable nature of teenagers, being a teenager at one point in my life, all of them, her loose comments that she made to her mother, if made to a teenager, can be so much more impactful. So I'm deferring to professional members. It sounds like we've probably addressed what that education is that she needs to have, but I want to make sure that it is. I just, I'm deferring.
Well,
like,
as a
Well, and one of the things she said, one of the comments she made was what was said as a joke, and all of us in this day and age know better than that. you know, whether you say it as a joke or not, you know it's inappropriate.
I don't know, so I would suggest the three C's in cultural humility and three in unconscious bias. I don't think that's too much. I think both exist.
And also talk about the one.
Supervision.
Professional conduct.
I think probably best done supervision, but I'm not aware if there's anything specific that we could be on supervision that would address that specifically.
I would agree. That's where I was going to go. Mm-hmm.
It's okay for me to behave in that type of way, but not in the school. I can't. You know, there's HR courses on how to kind of workplace or like bullying the workplace, which is
And it's.
I wanted to be your statement. You said that you have to behave professionally in professional setting, and with all those companies, no, I don't have to. It's an opportunity I provide for myself.
I think we also may have an opportunity here to provide some ethics and boundaries training, especially given the work she'll be doing with teenagers and the Facebook interactions. Right? Social media is everywhere and that's been very complicated.
He's thrown out a lot. Do you want to read back what you have and then we can let you know?
Can we talk about the supervision timeline and details?
I have two questions. I just want to hear, but we haven't even solidified, I think, the coursework or
That was my clarifying question. So I have, right now, we'd be offering six CEUs in staying out of trouble or equivalent, three CEUs in cultural sensitivity, three CEUs in unconscious bias. For clinical supervision, focus would be on, I kind of listed some of the same things, cultural humility, board statutes, rules, burnout, compassion, fatigue, self-development of therapist, professional conduct, ethics and boundaries, bullying, and unconscious bias.
So then it would be, do we want anything with the workplace specifically other than supervision? Is what I, from the discussion, is there something else, or would we want to replace something? Are we good with that?
I mean, that's a lot. At the same time, if you're with an agency, you need to be familiar with the policies. You need to be familiar with the procedures and, so those things, and then there's required training that, you need to really invest yourself when you're taking those reliance or whatever it is training to not just, go fast, but how to use that. Well, something that I'm hearing too is, I know, before we request that from additional HR teams, is that something also that the supervisor at the agency should be attuned with if there's something happening that the supervisor would address that you would hope that would be addressed in the workplace?
I would want to be thinking about certified HR training, because we are the board of employment representative, and so I'm real comfortable asking that HR training to be very helpful. HR training might be really good, and it might be extremely beneficial, but I'd be just boring.
Yeah, sometimes it isn't good, I will say. And
you know, I think professionalism covers where we want to go with this. So,
yeah,
I'm comfortable with that.
We have, oh, sorry. Just moving us along, so I think we're all the frequency of supervision then. So if we're going to include the professionalism in that.
Right. So I would say 2 years, at least the first year, potentially, well, it's really the applicant. So I would say for the 2 years,
I think the second year should be based off of the supervisor, but I do think that we should put a limit on it at least once a month for the second year. It seems behavior is bad, but applicant, newer to the profession, first year weekly, I totally agree. Second year, I agree, no early release, but I think we might be a little bit too punitive on the second year. I think they might be more comfortable with it. Unless supervisor says that, weekly, exactly, two, or, once a month. I'm okay with once a month if the supervisor decides, but I want at least once a month for the second year. Or something.
I think the reason why I was thinking for 2 years before,
when
somebody's looking for a certificate of licensure, they have to be also weekly-ish. And so she's at that very beginning starting point of bringing that extra,
about twice a month for the second year. Split the difference.
I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that. Sorry.
And I don't want to chase the applicant away, because if they're the perfect person to be here, I'm not going to raise your hand. So, I don't want to chase the applicant away. The idea is to kind of rein it in, educate, and perhaps incorporate some of that understanding, some of the human understanding, so that this is the best licensee that she can be.
Manager, can I? Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry, though. I just want to just add something to that, and I'm not suggesting anything different, but I just want to make sure that you all are aware. I would say about 50% of individuals that are disciplined are on consent agreements that are needed clinical supervision. The majority of it is contracted outside of the agency for various reasons. And I'm just saying that respectfully. I'm not, again, I think it's important that people get rehabilitated and they know the right thing, but I think you all are talking as if she's going to get it from this agency she's working at, and about 50% of the time they have to go outside of the agency. So I think that's something just to be considered. One thing is, in light of that, if I'm mindful of the fact this is an LIC application, if it turns out that it needs to be someone outside and it is cost prohibitive for some reason, that's something she can raise with us another time, I guess. With that said, that wasn't really my intent in sharing that, because I think it's really important as a licensee or as an applicant, if there's conduct that occurred where you need to be clinically supervised, I think the board has a responsibility to make sure that happens. I was just clarifying because I was getting the impression that some of our members thought that it was always coming from that agency, and it's not. So I think cost prohibitive is always something that's in the back of our minds, but I think we always have to be cautious of that as a regulatory board. If the conduct is there, it's important to make sure that we rehabilitate them so it doesn't occur again.
As an LAC, it's also the discipline that has the greatest options for supervision, so it's not social worker MFT, which will require discipline specific. So I feel more comfortable with that, but that's just
okay. Be back when we get this. So we'll be offering the licensee a consent, or the applicant, a consent agreement for 24 months. She would be required to take 6 CEUs in staying out of trouble or the equivalent, 3 CEUs in cultural sensitivity, 3 CEUs in unconscious bias. She also would be required to get clinical supervision once a week for the first year. After the first year, it can be at the recommendation of the clinical supervisor, but no less than twice monthly.
The focus would be on cultural humility, board statutes, rules, burnout, compassion, fatigue, self-development as a therapist, professional conduct, ethics, boundaries, bullying, unconscious bias, and if not signed, she would be denied for unprofessional conduct.
Is that your motion?
Yes, I'd like to make a motion.
Second.
Roll call, please.
Kimberly Bowie.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Mary Kunan.
Aye.
Cedric Davis.
Aye.
Patricia Dobatz.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Polly Knapp.
Aye.
Megan Kramer.
Aye.
Adelisa Meek.
Aye.
Diana Palacios.
Aye.
Mark Shin.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
Motion passes. Ms. Deja, reiterate what Mr. Davis said. It may sound like a lot, but you're allowed to get a license and hopefully lay the foundation to not see us again in this capacity. Okay? Best of luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Now, do we have status on lunch? Lunch just got here, so it's going to take just a few minutes. We can move on to the next one if you want and then take a break. Okay, so we will be going to agenda item number 7K, Timothy McDonald. Is the applicant present? The applicant is not present.
Madam Chair, members of the board, we have Timothy McDonald in front of us as a LASAC applicant. This matter is before the board for review, consideration, and action regarding whether to grant his request for withdrawal of his pending application. If his request to withdraw is denied, the board may want to consider whether to open a complaint and impose disciplinary action based on the results of the background investigation.
So, Madam Chair, at this time, I just as a reminder, we do have a statute when an individual applies for licensure. Once they're notified of an investigation, they're unable to withdraw their application. If board staff feels that if it came to the board, it would rise to the level of disciplinary action. Just want to clarify that, especially particularly for the newer members. So.
An applicant for licensure must meet the requirements of ARS 32-3275A6, which includes the following. Not have committed any act or engage in any conduct that would constitute grounds for disciplinary action against a licensee pursuant to this chapter. Following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violations. ARS 32-3251-16V, engaging in any sexual conduct between a licensee and a client or a former client. This recommendation is based on the following. On 1/24/22, the board received applicant's LASAC application. On 2/10/22, board staff received a report from the Department of Public Safety outlining multiple arrests for applicant. On 3/12/22, applicant provided a statement addressing his arrest and disclosed the following regarding a 10/20 arrest. Applicant entered into a contractual relationship as a carpenter and counselor with client. Client paid for construction work as well as counseling. Applicant and client became attracted and sexual with one another. When he revealed that he did not want to be romantic anymore, client screamed, cried, and began acting out in the camper. After he attempted to console her, client became aggressive and dropped her phone and went to the police. On 6/20/22, during a phone conversation with board staff, applicant disclosed the following. He provided services to client in his own agency from 5/20 to 8/20 while concurrently providing carpentry services. In 9/20, applicant and client began having a romantic relationship after they stopped therapy services. It was more or less unofficial and there was no contract signed. Applicant did not expect payment from client, but she was appreciative of his help. Applicant does not have counseling records, but she paid because she wanted to pay. Based on applicant's written statement and verbal communications with board staff, it appears he had a sexual relationship with a former client.
Madam Chair, before we go further, I also would like the board members to consider a violation of CI, making any oral or written misrepresentation of a fact to secure or attempt to secure the issuance of a renewal or an issuance of a license. We didn't put that in here originally because we had the Y violation for a sexual relationship. With that said, I think it's important to note that it was a pretty egregious application in the sense that did not disclose any any criminal actions. In fact, there were several. So I would like the board members to consider the CI violation as well. And just as a reminder, the first vote would be whether or not you would allow Mr. McDonald to withdraw his application.
Thank you both. Are there questions for board staff?
Based on the statute of, if I'm hearing correctly, cannot be able to withdraw, I would make a motion to not withdraw.
Deny. Request withdraw. Perfect.
Deny request
withdraw. Is there a second?
Bailey, second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Okay.
Also, I think it's pretty ridiculous. All over this, and so I would like to, if anyone has any other thoughts about this, but I would like to make a motion to open it. Okay, so based upon ARS 3232-B116, I believe that's a V, sexual relationship engaging in any sexual contact between a licensee or formal client,
you said CI
too? CI, yes. I wrote that down, CI as well.
Okay. So the motion over the complaints, find the violations. Is there a second?
Not a second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Also like to make a motion to deny
for unprofessional conduct. Is there a second?
Maybe second.
Quick. Roll call, please. Kimberly Mary.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Mary Curran.
Aye.
Cedric Davis.
Aye.
Patricia Dobutz.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Colleen Knapp.
Aye.
Megan Kramer.
Aye.
Adeline Zemeek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Mark Shane.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
Motion carries. It is 11:53. We'll break for lunch. Come back at 12:20. All right, we are going to come back to order. It is 12:23.
Very clear.
And we will go to agenda item 7-0, Julia Stan. And I believe you said the licensee was not going to be present. Is that correct?
That is correct.
All right. Summary from board staff, whenever you're ready.
Madam Chair, members of the board, this matter is before you regarding Ms. Stan's request to be released from her ICA. If the board releases licensee from her interim consent agreement, it needs to determine whether to accept a consent agreement with terms and conditions necessary to ensure that she can practice safely and competently. So following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 32-3251-16L, engaging in any conduct, practice, or condition that impairs the ability of the licensee to safely and competently practice the licensee's profession. And ARS 32-3251-16CI, making any oral or written misrepresentation of a fact to secure or attempt to secure the issuance or renewal of a license. This recommendation is based on the following. In 9/20, licensee submitted her LMSW renewal application with the board and answered yes to the background questions regarding a previous arrest. Licensee indicated she was not aware at the time of the board's rules regarding mandatory reporting of criminal charges within 10 days. Licensee reported a 220 DUI, and board staff subsequently forwarded standard substance use and behavioral health questions to licensee for her written response. Licensee represented the following in her 7/8/21 written response. She has not been honest with herself and has taken licensee a long time to realize she has struggled with alcohol. Licensee has been attending AA, has a strong support system, and her husband has told her she has an issue with alcohol. Licensee has participated in services for her alcohol issues at two separate facilities in the past. Licensee does not have an exact sobriety date, but has been able to remain sober for months at a time in the past. Licensee does not bring her personal struggles to work, and her substance use has never caused issues at work. Licensee has also been seeing a psychiatrist for 3 years for bipolar. Licensee's alcohol use has exacerbated suicidal ideation in the past. Due to licensee's admission to ongoing alcohol issues, she was in agreement to signing an interim consent agreement suspending her license until the time she felt safe and competent to practice. In 7/22, licensee requested to be released from her ICA and have her license reinstated. On 7/11/22, licensee provided a written statement in regards to her request to be released, which included the following in part. Since 2014, licensee has worked at UHS of Delaware and currently works at the Belmont Pines location. Licensee has never arrived to any job under the influence of any substances. Licensee has not drunk alcohol since 11/17/21 and has remained sober through the following. Help from family, friends, and ongoing therapy. She subscribes to different social media groups specific to recovery and listens to sober podcasts. Licensee goes to therapy to address why she even drinks to begin with. Licensee exercises and has hired a personal trainer. She has been working towards obtaining a certificate through ASU related to substance use. On 11/21, licensee attempted suicide, and this is what led licensee to get sober. From 11/21/19 to 11/23/19, licensee engaged in detox services for severe alcohol dependence with Laurel Wood and discharged without meeting the goal of detoxing safely. From 11/24/19 to 11/25/19, licensee again went to Laurel Wood for detox services and reported drinking 1 to 2 bottles of wine every other day. From 12/19 to 2/20, licensee engaged in IOP services with Glen Bay, which included the following in part. Licensee started drinking when she was 14 and has been drinking about 2 bottles of wine per night for the past 2 years. Licensee attended 19 IOP sessions and completed all treatment plan assignments. It was recommended upon discharge that licensee attend AA meetings, maintain a sponsor, and begin private counseling. On 2/17/20, licensee was admitted to Glen Bay for detox services after receiving a DUI, and her records included the following in part. She was admitted to address her substance use disorder. It was recommended licensee attend 90 AA meetings in 90 days, participate in activities offered by the recovery community, and have daily contact with a sponsor and obtain a home group within 30 days. Licensee's relapse potential was high at the time of discharge due to her not having a sponsor to help with the development of a strong recovery foundation. Licensee was unwilling to have Glen Bay schedule IOP treatment, as licensee reported she needed to check with her employer. Since 12/17, licensee has been receiving psychiatric services from a psychiatrist. Trouble Regional Medical Center records indicated licensee was brought in for a suicide attempt after taking multiple handfuls of pills, and licensee reported her alcohol use led her to the suicide attempt. From 11/21 to 3/22, licensee engaged in outpatient services with Brightview, which included the following in part. Licensee was diagnosed with alcohol use disorder, severe, and unspecified depressive disorder. Licensee had been drinking a bottle of wine daily for years and ended up in the hospital after an intentional overdose. Licensee has missed work due to her alcohol use. 11/16/21 is the date licensee last drank alcohol. A 1/20/22 medical visit indicated licensee reported taking a CBD gummy around Thanksgiving and hated it. Licensee's discharge summary indicated her last date of services as 1/6/22, and licensee had requested to cease services. Licensee did not develop a relapse prevention plan, and it was recommended she complete one. Since 2/22, licensee has participated in therapy services with Sherry Cooper, which included the following. On 3/9/22, licensee was diagnosed with alcohol dependence in remission. Licensee reported her recent suicide attempt and has abstained from alcohol use since, but admits to a slip-up. Licensee denied any current suicidal ideation plan or intent. Sherry Cooper wrote a letter indicating licensee has attended 11 sessions and has shown significant improvement in her overall well-being. Licensee has never had any adverse or disciplinary actions at any of her employers. During an investigative interview, licensee represented the following. She feels alcohol did not impact her work because she would complete her job when she went to work. Licensee admitted missing work due to her alcohol use and has not missed work due to alcohol since 11/17/21. Licensee is unsure what her triggers are. She considers 11/18/21 as her sobriety date and does not feel the slip-up restarts her sobriety date. From 2019 to 2022, licensee was in denial about her alcohol issues, which may have been why she was not as transparent at the beginning of this process. Licensee denied taking any CBD gummy as reported in her records from Brightview and is unsure where that came from. Licensee does not feel AA or a sponsor has helped her. She did not feel the services at Brightview were very helpful as well.
licensee feels safe and competent to practice. Despite licensee engaging in a number of inpatient and outpatient services since 2019, it is concerning licensee seems to discharge from programs without adequate continuity of care in place. It's highly concerning that licensee represents her alcohol use never impacted her work, when in fact she has missed work even had multiple leaves of absences due to her alcohol issues. Licensee feels meditation, exercise, and a less stressful job have helped her mentally and emotionally. Licensee also considers her husband her accountability partner and feels she has great support from family and friends. She has remained consistent with her psychiatrist and current therapist for several months. On licensee's 920 renewal application, she omitted any information regarding prior behavioral health or substance use issues. Specifically in 2019 and 2020, prior to her renewal application, licensee engaged in inpatient detox services and outpatient services for alcohol use. Licensee misrepresented on her renewal application by answering no to the question regarding any treatment or services she has received in the past 5 years. And that is all I have, unless you have questions.
Question from board members, from Mr. Carter. Thank you. Dr. Hennigan, I believe you're leading this discussion.
I have a question. Thank you so much to involve in this. I have a very good question for the life of the I do agree with the findings of the IRS 5116 IIDP, have a practical condition. The transferability of the licensee patient to the practice licensee profession. I have ARS 32-331. Based on all the information, I have great concern that she doesn't leave any way from her treatment when, as a clinician, she is supposed to secure that discharge plan, and it would be important to catch her with care, and she herself is not following that. I also have concern with the minimization of, even though she says this, you know, it's never affected my work, but she doesn't see she had a serious suicide attempt to be out, like, for a significant amount of time. And just the downplay, which was is part of the disease that happened. And I'm not sure.
Can I ask a point of clarification, sorry, before you continue, just for this is off? Because she's on an ICA, if we don't think that enough has been done, rather than finding the violations, we can just deny the release, first of all, if we wanted to go that route versus...
That is correct, and that was probably good for me to maybe kind of share that, especially with some of the newer members. Ms. Stan went on the ICA for a substance abuse issue, and the intent was that she would work on her recovery efforts. And has now come back, asked to be released. So really, that would be the first decision. If the board members choose to release her, then I would encourage you to consider finding the violations and possibly offer her a consent agreement. If you don't feel that she's demonstrated that she's there yet, I would ask that you consider denying the release, but then I think memorially maybe have a little discussion on what you'd like to see, because that's what's going to happen. She's going to want to understand what else do the board members want to see and hear.
And just a clarification, I understand that she's now living in Ohio.
That is correct.
And I don't know how we as a board would monitor her.
Well, it depends on, so we would have regulatory authority over her because she has our license. So somebody that is suffering from a substance abuse issue, oftentimes we would basically maybe do biological fluid testing. She could do that from Ohio and we could get the results here. We may require her to get education. She could do that here. Really the only thing that would be difficult would be like a clinical supervision, and probably in this case we may not. It may be more of a therapeutic. She could technically get therapy in Ohio. So it is different. It's different to monitor, but it's not something we've not done before.
So I would back up and say that, well, in here,
I have a question. So she's on a consent agreement right now.
She's got an interim consent agreement, which means her license is suspended. So she cannot use her license, her Arizona license, because her license is suspended.
Okay.
Until she requests release from the board and the board feels she's safe and competent to practice.
Okay.
And for the new members, you haven't seen something like this before, so I can see how it...
Okay. I think a couple things are missing for me thus far. And I mean, it's really difficult when we have these and we don't have a licensee to ask the questions for or see and hear, right? And so that's one thing that is difficult to gauge without our present. For me, the time, too, I don't think there's been, you know, a lot of times we look for 2 years, or I just don't feel like the time has passed. And then the accountability piece, and maybe this shows my ignorance because it's not my discipline, but to not recognize your sobriety date as being your sobriety date, like the slip up is okay, doesn't make sense for me to reconcile. So I just feel like there maybe hasn't been as much formal treatment and reflection, and the family support is great, but having really dove into the addiction and the behavioral health concerns.
That would be my concern as well, right? The time, the not knowing, you know, your sobriety date.
I'm really struggling to understand how long she has actively been in therapy and sober. Not from the beginning to, like, in this last...
Since the last discharge from the one.
Wasn't it March?
I feel like it's a few months, and that's what I'm...
She left AMA.
Concern as well. And then also, in recovery, a lot of times we'll say relapse is a normal part of recovery, depending on which model you're following, the harm reduction or, you know. And so, that's not a part of recovery, but it's also, if you slip up, you're still not sober.
Since she didn't see that slip up as an issue.
Right. Uh-huh. Right. But, and that's why I say she minimizes
And I wonder if her not being here today,
is that part of, you know, oh, I never, you know, went in fair to work. You know, this relapse is not really here.
I think in her supplemental documentation, she says it's because she started the new job, and she didn't want her, she didn't feel comfortable asking for time off.
And then, may I address that? Because I think it's important. So because this case came before us, and Mr. Carver had told me that she wasn't planning on being in attendance or planning to participate via phone, and I pretty much said I'm not comfortable taking it to the board without her being present because the board members are going to want to see her. And we shared that with her, and she asked for us to go ahead and move forward, where we could have waited a month or two or 3 months down the road where she did feel more comfortable taking the time off, because I think it is important. And this is a big request. And if you're in a different state, you recognize you may not be here, but to be able to add this question. I just want to, just for the record, board staff always takes those kinds of things into consideration.
Thank you.
Sorry, sorry that she stood up on our triggers.
Background in addiction, the one thing that stands out for me, she keeps repeating this, she's working out, which is great, you should work out. That's part of recovery. But to the degree she's doing it, she could not be into addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a component depending on how into the workout she is, she doesn't switch over to steroids. So I always have that of watching the
Do you want to make a motion?
Yes. Well, I would like to deny the request for reason.
Is there a second?
Lots of seconds.
Do you need a roll call for that?
We do not.
We don't?
No.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion carries. Right, and I believe our last matter, 7P, Tamara Van Buckel.
That is correct. All right. Madam Chair, members of the board, This is before you today to consider accepting a proposed signed interim consent agreement. As a reminder, an ICA is a suspension of your license. This matter was heard before our board in May of 2022. The board members found for the violation, and they also ordered a psychological evaluation of our licensee. Our licensee is currently undergoing some behavioral health as well as medical issues and is not in a position to complete the psychological evaluation. She actually did complete it but had some issues with the results of it, wanted to redo it. And after talking to her, it sounds like she needs some time off to work on herself and not just her behavioral health issues but also her medical issues. So board staff offered her an ICA. What this would look like if you accepted this ICA is her license would be suspended. And again, just like you just saw, at the time that she felt she was safe and competent to practice, she would have to come back to the board, and at that time she would have to be able to provide that psychological evaluation.
Any questions from board members? Thank you, Paul. Mr. Trotter.
I motion we accept the
second. Roll call, please.
Kimberly Bailey.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Mary Coonrod.
Aye.
Cedric Davis.
Aye.
Patricia Joe Lutz.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Holly Knapp.
Aye.
Megan Kramer.
Aye.
Adelaide Meek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Mark Shin.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
If I'm following my notes correctly, Ms. Vall, we have public comment left. Is that correct? And then next meeting?
Correct.
Great. A very small public now compared to what it was an hour ago. You're doing a great job. We appreciate you being here. This is the time and place for public comment. So we're not allowed to answer questions or engage on specific matters. But if there's anything that you wanted to come forward and address the board on the record, you would have up to 5 minutes to do so. So I don't know if either of you have interest in that. Thank you. Spread the word. The more licensees that come and attend, I think the better. Thank you though. All right, our next meeting is Friday, November 4th. As Ms. Zavala has mentioned to all of us, it should be a relatively short, briefer meeting, and then the December meeting will be a lengthier meeting, correct?
That's correct.
And do we have anybody who has notified you that they can't be here yet for either of those?
No.
So if you're in attendance, and we'll be back to our regular starting time, 9 a.m. I think we did a better time of getting here by 8, but. So if you find out that you can't make the November or December meeting, if you can, let Toby know as soon as possible. It would be much appreciated. But thank you all for adjusting your schedules and being here. And this was great to have all 12 seats filled and present. So thank you all very much. Is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved, Otter.
Second? All right, have a great weekend, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you.